This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on June 15th, 2011. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Morning. The open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Wednesday, June 15th will come to order. The first item on our agenda is the correction and approval of minutes. Vice Chair, do we have a motion?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move to approve agenda document number 11-34, minutes for the open session held on May 26, 2011.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Aye. Motion carries 6-0. We have a number of late submitted documents on our agenda. Vice Chair, do we have a motion to consider those?
Yes, we do. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider the late submission of agenda document numbers 11-33, 11-33A, 11-35, 11-36, 11-32, 11-32A, and 11-32B.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Thank you for that motion. The first substantive item on our agenda are alternative notices of proposed rulemakings governing independent expenditures and electioneering communications by corporations and labor organizations. This is a repeat from our agenda in January. In January, we were unable to agree to a proposed rulemaking to put out for public comment. It's back on our agenda to an attempt to move the agency forward in how to respond to the court's decision. It should be clear from the revised documents that we have come a lot closer to an agreement about what the scope of topics should be in this NPRM for public comment, and I want to thank my colleagues for all of the discussion, long discussions about what should be in these documents. Both drafts recognize that we must address some elements of our reporting rules, and that, I think, reflects progress from where we were in January. I personally think it's important that we ask whether our existing rules must be revised to ensure they continue to serve their original purpose in light of the repeal of the prohibition on corporate expenditures. It appears there still may not be four votes to ask, for example, whether we should get public comment on whether the Commission should consider its regulation, which currently provides for more limited reporting for ECs for corporations and labor organizations. This is one area where the two drafts do differ. Draft A contains alternative proposals for modifying the current rules. One would maintain the status quo in which corporations and labor organizations are treated differently from others, persons making those expenditures. The other alternative would rescind the special provision for reporting by electioneering communications by corporations and labor organizations. Draft B, in contrast, proposes a revision to the rule text limited to eliminating the cross-references that would be accomplished by other parts of the proposal, which I would agree would need to be done were we to eliminate 114.15. And the draft also briefly solicits comment on the clarity of the current reporting regulations and about possible changes to the Commission's forms. Again, I really appreciate my colleagues providing that additional content to the draft that they're willing to support. From my perspective, it doesn't go quite far enough. I really do think we need to ask about maintaining the distinction in the reporting in this area for corporations, labor unions, and everyone else making electioneering communications. And frankly, while draft A is not exactly my preferred route, it is much narrower than the proposal that my colleagues and I put forward in January. In my view, it is the minimum we should be asking about in response to the court's decision. As you will notice, the next item on the agenda, being a practical person, I recognize that we may not be able to put out a full NPRM on these topics. We do have two notices pending, or I'm sorry, petitions pending with the Commission that we must take action on if we are not able to include them in an NPRM, and so those are on the agenda for the Commission's consideration later this morning. Again, I would prefer to put out an NPRM which more fully addresses all of these issues. If we're unable to do that, others outside of the building have presented issues for us for our consideration, and we will need to take appropriate actions under the regs with respect to those petitions. That's why they're on the agenda. That's my concern about draft B. And like I said, while draft A is not my preference, I would be willing to support it today. I'll open the floor to anyone else who has comment on these two agenda items. No other comment. Commissioner Weintraub.
I thought maybe somebody on the other side of the table might want to talk next. I think we have come a lot closer. And I haven't given up yet. I'm you know, work with me, guys. Come on. We took a lot of stuff out of our draft, issues that we wanted to raise and questions that we wanted to ask. And, you know, we did a real tough red line on ourselves and stripped it down a lot. And, you know, I'm willing to talk about taking more out. And you've added some stuff in, and I think it's important. And some of the disagreements at this point come down to some really small stuff. I mean, your draft... I mean, everybody, I think, acknowledges at this point that we have, if we're going to take out 11 CFR 114.15 from the regs book, we have to also take out the references to that in other places, and that includes in 104.20, 8 and 9, the reporting provisions for ECs. And the question is, how many words are we going to take out around the numbers? Because we can't just take out the numbers because the sentence wouldn't make sense. Then you would have a sentence that read, in 8, for example, if the disbursements were not paid exclusively from a segregated bank account described in paragraph C7 of this section and were not made by a corporation or labor organization pursuant to the name and address of each donor who donated an amount aggregating blah, blah, blah. I mean, the sentence wouldn't make sense. So obviously, you've got to take out a few more words than just the citation itself. Now, what you have proposed, what my colleagues have proposed, is pursuant to 11 CFR 114.15. What I am suggesting is that we take out a few more words in front of that, and were not made by a corporation or labor organization pursuant to 11 CFR 114.15, which would actually change the meaning of the provision. Then it would read, if the disbursements were not paid exclusively from a segregated bank account, what would have to be disclosed would be the name and address of each donor who donated an amount aggregating 1,000 or more to the person making the disbursement, aggregating since the first day of the preceding calendar year, which would return it to the status that the regulation was in post-BCRA and before the Wisconsin Right to Life rulemaking, which is, you know, what triggered the lawsuit, which then struck down 114.15. The underpinnings of the Wisconsin Right to Life rulemaking were substantially knocked out by CU. We all agree about that. And it seems to me to be a perfectly legitimate question to ask, well, should we then just eliminate everything that the commission did in response to Wisconsin Right to Life? Because what my colleagues have proposed is to eliminate part of it, but to leave part of it, which would sort of leave it in a state that's somewhere in between where the rules were after BCRA and where the rules were after the Wisconsin Right to Life rulemaking. And I can't quite get my mind around why that's an illegitimate question to ask. Why we cannot ask, in addition to, should we take out 5 words from this regulation? Alternatively, should we take out 15 words? How can that be an impermissible question? How can you not let us ask that question? I know you don't want to censor me. That would be contrary to all of your most deeply held beliefs to be engaged in government censorship. All we want to do is ask a few more questions and pose another alternative. And, you know, similarly, Section 9 of that regulation was added in response to the Wisconsin Right to Life decision and as part of that rulemaking. And I would like to ask whether we should repeal that provision in light of Citizens United. And again, I just don't see how you can possibly say that question is illegal. It's impermissible. We cannot hear from the public on that. We do not want to hear from them. If they try to send us comments, we're going to cover our ears. We're just trying to have a wide open, robust debate, which is what the First Amendment is supposed to be all about. You know, you've come a little ways. I think we've come further. I'm willing to go a little further. I'm hoping you're willing to go a little further. Work with me. Come on. We can get a little closer on this, because I think everybody out there and everybody who's listening and everybody who's going to read about this meeting would really, really like us to put out an NPRM. And it seems really silly to me that we're not going to be able to do this today, if indeed that is the case, because some people are only willing to ask about 5 words and not 15 words. Or maybe, to be completely honest, 15 words and one paragraph. Come on, guys. It's not a tenable position to take, to say those questions are beyond the scope of what we are doing here. Those questions are illegal. We can only ask about part of the sentence. We can't ask about the other part of the sentence. That's not where you guys really want to be making arguments like that. I'm prepared to support draft A and today, and not draft B, but I'm also completely committed to continuing to work to find a place in between those two drafts. I believe that place can be found. If people are just willing to move, we've moved a little bit, let's move a little bit more and just try and get this done.
Vice Chair Hunter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If it were only so easy.
Why isn't it?
And I agree with you that it's silly that we're not able to adopt an NPRM today. Especially since there's a huge chunk at the beginning of both of our proposals. It was at 1.75 pages. I didn't count this time. But it's a lot that we agree on. So why not move that out now and then deal with what we all agree are the thornier issues later? And that's been our proposal from the beginning. As you know, a lot of this, I feel a little bit like Groundhog Day. We've talked about all of this on January 20th. And while it's true that we kind of forgot to remove the cross-reference last time, so I didn't realize that that was so illuminating, removing a cross-reference to a reg that everybody agrees is likely not enforceable any longer. And we asked about the forms. Should we change the forms to tell corporations that they can make independent expenditures? Again, I didn't think that was terribly illuminating, but I'm glad you think that was helpful. We're really in the same place we were in January, which is the Supreme Court issued a landmark decision nearly a year and a half ago to find much of the law unconstitutional, and obviously we want to remove those regulations from the books. They're still there. And I don't know how the agency can defend keeping those regulations on the books for this long. Of course, the words that you're talking about, those nine or however many words you're talking about, it's the crux of the disagreements that we've been having for a year and a half. And we don't believe that anything in the Supreme Court's decision is relevant to increasing disclosure, to adding additional regulations that require more disclosure. I know you're going to pull out the same sentences that you read last time, and I read them again last night. I don't think that anything in there requires the FEC or even suggests that the FEC increase disclosure. The way I read the opinion is that the Supreme Court said, look, there's disclosure out there. Citizens United wanted to have no disclosure on their ECs, and the Supreme Court said, no, we're upholding the current disclosure regime, which is what we have now. The other practical reason that I mentioned in January for the reason that we don't want to add these issues to this rulemaking is all evidence points to we're never going to get a rulemaking at the back end if we add these things in there, because so far you've not been willing to do a rulemaking on the core issues of Citizens United, and there's no evidence that our colleagues are willing to vote out a rule on the back end that won't include those issues. So that's another practical reason for not wanting to move forward today in raising those issues that, again, we don't believe were addressed by the Supreme Court.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Okay, I have to read the words. You said I would do it, and I have to do it. Supreme Court said, with the advent of the Internet, prompt disclosure of expenditures can provide shareholders and citizens with the information needed to hold corporations and elected officials accountable for their positions and supporters. Shareholders can determine whether their corporation's political speech advances the corporation's interest in making profits, and citizens can see whether elected officials are in the pocket of so-called moneyed interest. The First Amendment protects political speech, and disclosure permits citizens and shareholders to react react to the speech of corporate entities in a proper way. This transparency enables the electorate to make informed decisions and give proper weight to different speakers and messages. The Supreme Court plainly endorsed disclosure of the sources of the money behind this kind of advertising. And that, to say that's not a core issue in CU, I think, is ignoring that was the core issue before the Supreme Court expanded it to include other issues. And I fully concede that they did expand it dramatically. But the disclosure issue remained in the case, and the Supreme Court clearly talked about it. And in any event, putting all of that aside, you still have not answered the question of how it can possibly be okay to ask about part of a sentence, but somehow impermissible to ask. Just ask the question. Ask for public comment. That's all we're doing at this point. We're not at the final rule stage. How can it be permissible to ask and necessary to ask about part of a sentence and completely illegitimate, impermissible, not allowed to ask questions about the rest of the sentence? How can that be true?
Vice Chair Hunter.
I thought I already answered that, because all we did was provide notice to the public that we wanted to remove a cross-reference to a reg that in another part of the NPRM we proposed striking. So it seems reasonable to tell the public that we're going to take that part out of the regs, and that's the reason that we bring up that provision. And then the other thing that you mentioned was you read from the Supreme Court opinion, and then you said, see, the Supreme Court thinks we should disclose the sources behind the funding, or whatever you said. And I didn't hear you read anything about the sources behind. You only said that after you read the quotes. The Supreme Court upheld the disclosure regime, and even in a portion of here, cites directly to our regs.
Commissioner Weintraub.
I'll read it again. This transparency enables the electorate to make informed decisions and give proper weight to different speakers and messages. Who is speaking is the fundamental question. But, you know, I understand that what you want to do is to remove five words. I understand that's what you want to do. What I'm asking is, why is it illegitimate to ask for public comment on the rest of the sentence? That has never been the way this commission has done business before, where we say you can only ask about part of a sentence, but you can't ask about the rest of the sentence. And it's arrogant to assume that all the knowledge in the world on this subject is contained at this table. All I want to do is open it up to the public and invite public comment. Why is that a bad thing? How can that be a bad thing? We are not at the end point. I'm not asking you to vote for any rule text. All I'm asking is to put some more questions in the NPRM, the notice, at the very beginning of the process. How can that be harmful?
Commissioner McGann.
The issue, as I see it, is what are we going to do, in what order? Are we going to do things separately? Are we going to do things in one big mass? And although we can wrap ourselves in the flag and have condescending language and laugh and giggle and all that, this is serious stuff. The reality is Citizens United is a game changer, but it's not just Citizens United. It's Emily's List, it's Speech Now, Unity 08, case after case after case. We have a lot of things on the books which shouldn't be on the books. The problem with having them on the books is there will be some people who will read the reg book and not realize that they've been struck, or that there are regs that were not squarely addressed by a particular court case, but the logic of a court case requires them to take them off the books. We're going to hold all that hostage because we want to do additional disclosure requirements. Now, whether or not we ought to do additional disclosure, which means undoing a rule in 2007 that was passed by the commission shortly before some of us joined, and some of us who are here voted for, right? We're going to change that rule, but why do we have to hold the other part of the rulemaking, meaning taking things off the books to ensure that people know they can exercise their rights? Why do we have to hold that hostage by having the disclosure part? Well, I'm not sure. There's a lot of politics floating around. You know, it's become, unfortunately, a charged issue. You know, the Disclose Act was not an easy thing to watch happen failed the Senate not once but twice. There's draft executive orders floating around. FCC's talking about doing things. IRS is doing who knows what. I mean, just reading the newspapers, it seems like there's a lot of this going on. But here we have other things I think we need to do first. Because, well, the FEC lost these cases when it came to the important things. Now, I hear Citizens United started out as a disclosure case and that kind of thing. That may be true, but it certainly didn't end that way. And what I don't understand is why we still haven't begun the process of taking regs off the books that have already been declared unconstitutional to ensure people can exercise their rights. We haven't even really gotten into Emily's List, which came out in 2009. CU came out in 2010, then Speech Now. And all these cases are just sitting there. We've gotten way behind on taking these things off the books. People have come in with AOs to try to piecemeal it. I mean, we can wrap ourselves in the flag, but what we don't mention is last night the commission was enjoined from going down a road that some wanted to go down, in an advisory opinion regarding a PAC who wanted to raise unlimited funds to do independent expenditures and raise money and give it to candidates. They wanted to have separate accounts. Two commissioners said, oh, no, you have to have two separate PACs. And an injunction was entered last night. And if you read the 21-page opinion, I've never seen an opinion that uses the word the commission failed more. Now, when it talks about the commission, it talks about two commissioners. Now, that opinion said, whichever candidates plaintiffs wish to support and issues they wish to espouse must be freed immediately from the chill of possible FEC enforcement. Immediately. Now, you could say, well, that's why we need to start a rulemaking. But why do we need to bog down the Citizens United issues? And I include in that Speech Now and Emily's List, which really aren't even part of our proposal, because those were things I wanted to put in, and I was told by several, oh, no, we don't have time for that. We've got to start small and then go big. Why do we have to hold hostage taking things off the books that have to come off the books, deal with things that may have to come off the books or may have to be rewritten in the wake of these cases in exchange for what seems to be a different rulemaking regarding disclosure? I want to talk about how the commission has worked. When the FEC loses a case, I've never seen a situation where the commission's actually gotten this bogged down and taking a reg off the books, with one exception where they said they weren't going to enforce a certain reg in a couple circuits. But at least the commission was able to say that. But now we're in a situation where to do what's essentially a new rulemaking, where you would have to have four commissioners affirmatively vote to launch it, well, we're going to ignore that, and we're just going to bootstrap onto what really needs to happen, which is taking things off the books. I mean, guys, come on. I mean, we got to get this stuff moving, and there's got to be a way that we can do this. My concern is if you add the disclosure piece to what really needs to happen, it's going to bog the whole thing down. Why can't we do the easy stuff and do this in smaller bites instead of holding the whole thing hostage?
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I agree with one thing that you said, in that this is very serious. And I'm sorry if my attempts to be friendly were misconstrued as not taking this seriously, because I am dead serious about this. I've been serious about the issue of disclosure for 20 years. You can talk about what's going on politically in other parts of town, but as I said in January, I've been doing disclosure issues, and I've been committed to those issues for 20 years. So, you know, I don't care what's going on in other parts of town. This has always been a huge issue for me. And, you know, why can't we do this? Because you're committed to doing it. The only way you're willing to do it is your way.
No.
What I'm saying is, the question is, how much are we going to strike of the sentence? You say, well, the only way that we can possibly do this is to strike these five words. We can't even consider whether another way of doing it is to strike 15 words. And I just don't think that's an intellectually defensible position. You can say, you know, you think it is. I hear you. But, you know, that's what we're arguing about, not whether we're going to strike words, but how many words we're going to strike. And reasonable people can disagree on how many words are necessary to strike to implement this opinion, but that's what we have a rulemaking process for, where we seek public comment.
Commissioner McGann.
Okay, one more time. Why are we holding hostage removing regs from the books? It's not about five words. It's about there are a lot of rules in the rule book that shouldn't be there or need to be rewritten because the premise of the rule has been fundamentally changed. Again, you're getting bogged down on the disclosure piece, which to me is a separate piece. And to say, well, you know, it's five words. It's not just five words. I mean, what's in our proposal? There's so much more that should be in what we're presenting today, but it's not because we're trying to find a way to get it out the door. But we can't because I feel like it's being held hostage. Now, it's maddening. You were enjoying last night from some of your theories. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, here's the court telling you, you know, people must be freed immediately from the chill of possible FEC enforcement, but yet here we are talking about what's essentially a different rulemaking. Why do we have to connect the two? There's a rule on the books that was passed in 2007 that you voted for that you want to change. Okay, I understand that. The rule was put in to avoid unions having to disclose everybody who gave for ads. I understand that. That's fine. Maybe it needs to be tweaked. Maybe it needs to be revamped. That's a different situation, though, I think, than what's on the books, which need to be removed. You know, and I out of the gate, the chair said we know, you know, how to respond to the Citizens United rulemaking. Rules, quote, I wrote down it as serve their original purpose. Well, how to respond? You comply with the court order. We've lost. Case after case after case. We can't sit here and pretend like, well, we're not sure if we lost. How do we implement a decision? You don't implement a decision unless it's a redistricting decision, then you implement the map. Otherwise, you comply. The disclosure part, ramping up and adding extra disclosure on independent speech, that's a different issue. And I still haven't heard an answer as to why that has to be a part of the larger rulemaking. Because as Commissioner Hunter alluded to, when this gets down the road, it'll become apparent why this is not just let's put it out there and see what happens, because it's going to bog down the decision at the end of the day. And it's going to hold the rulemaking hostage then, because to take rules off the books, you're going to want to add more rules to the books. That's not what should happen here. These should not be linked the way you're insisting on linking them.
Commissioner Weintraub.
I actually want to take words off the books, rules off the books. I want to take more rules off the books than you do. But
that's hard to believe.
It's true, though.
Well,
how about 104.20C9? I think that's C. 104.29. You know, let's take that off the books. But the point is, we all agree we want to comply with the court. We disagree on how to comply with the court. And that is what the rulemaking process is for. And there is not only one way, the way that Don McGahn says is the only way. That is not the only way of the world.
No, it's not. I mean, Judge Collier has a way, too.
That's not an issue here today. I understand you got
it. Oh, it's not an issue.
Like
okay.
No, it's not.
Oh, no.
We're not talking about that decision. Obviously, we'll comply with that decision, but we're talking about Citizens United here today.
When are we going to comply with that decision?
We are attempting to do so today.
September 09, Emily's List came out. We took a couple of regs off the books. The logic of Emily's List is still driving a lot of these regs, and we still seem confused on whether somebody can have a pack and how much money they can raise. When are we going to do that?
I am trying to comply with what is underlying what you keep talking about, what the logic of the opinion was to strike down WRTL and everything we did in response to WRTL. Now, we can debate, you know, how many words we have to strike down.
Well, wait
we
a
can
second.
Have that
hold
debate.
On, hold on, hold on. Now, I'm hearing two things. I'm hearing Citizens United upheld disclosure, but yet it struck down everything you did in WRTL. But yet in upholding the disclosure, it actually cited to the FEC's rulemaking in 2007. So all that language you read, that lofty prose about, you know, disclosure regime, the disclosure regime the court was talking about is the one that's already on the books. Now, we can keep talking about whether we have to fix it. Look, the forms are messed up. We all agree with that. If you're a corporation and you're trying to do an independent expenditure, you look at the form and it tells you, do not use this form if you're a corporation. You can only do it if you're an MCFL corporation. So if you're a corporation, what are you supposed to file? Well, if you know to call RAD or you read the press release, you know to use the form. But if you're a lawyer and you don't know that, and your client says, should I sign this under oath? You'll say, no, it's the instructions clearly say you can't use it. So certainly things need to be done. But why do we need to tie the heavier lift, the thing that is a much more difficult issue, which should be with what should be easier things, which is complying with court orders? You don't have to comply with the order of the U.S. Supreme Court and Citizens United by adding extra disclosure. That's not complying with the order. Complying with the order is removing the regs on the books that have effectively been struck down or have been modified. Why can't we do that first? Why do we have to bog this down with new disclosure? Emily's List came out in, September 2009? Holy cow. Holy cow.
Commissioner Weintraub.
We all agree that we have to take some words out of Section 8 and Section 9 of 104.20. All we are arguing about is how many words do we have to take out. That's the whole argument. How many words are we going to take out? And you can sit there and say as many times as you want that taking out a few extra words is not what the court required. The court required us to take out these five words and only these five words, but the court actually didn't address those five words. So all we're arguing about is how many words we have to delete in order to comply with the court's decision, which we all agree we have to do. That's the whole issue. And you say we can only look at five words, and I say we ought to look at the whole paragraph. That's the whole issue. And I just want to get some public comment on it. You know, we're going around and round at this point. We're not making a lot of progress. I'm sorry about that. I really think we ought to be able to resolve this. Believe me, I am as frustrated as you are. I also feel like, I'm being held hostage by people who are only willing to consider one alternative and one way of doing business. You know, this is the way I understand the court opinion, and nobody in the world is allowed to provide us with comment to suggest that maybe there's another way of reading the court opinion, maybe the court opinion addresses more than those five words. I don't understand why you're so afraid of letting the public into this process and hearing what they have to say on how many words we're going to delete. And it is, I admit, an unusual circumstance. I'm not proposing to add any words at all. I want to take out more words than you do.
With respect to the Commissioner McGann's, statement about immediately following Emily's List, we did take regs off the books. The court struck down specific regulations. I agree with you. I accept that we lost in Citizens United, and we have to comply with that decision. But the court did not enumerate a list of our regulations and strike them down. Instead, it struck down a portion of the statute, and there was a lot of discussion about other concepts around corporations and labor unions that obviously have implications for the regulations in our books. But it isn't as easy as just taking things off the books. There's a question of what to take off and what portions, and some of it is very easy. Some things can just simply be struck out, but there's obviously, with respect to the reporting regulations, a cross-reference. And I agree with Commissioner Weintraub that what we're really asking about is, now that 114.15 no longer exists, should 9, the provision that was implemented to or was adopted to specifically address that new regulation after the court's decision, should that continue to exist? I don't think that's holding anything hostage. I think it's trying to have a complete discussion rather than a discussion limited in only one particular way. And frankly, I would like us to be able to do more than one rulemaking at a time. I think there are a number of other issues that we should be tackling, and I would like to turn to as many of those, including discussions about where we should go with Emily's List in over the summer, if we can. I think we need to do that. But I disagree that it's as easy in this particular case as just striking out particular regs. In where cases strike down our regs, we have acted very quickly to do that, as we did in Emily's List. In this case, we did announce that we are not going to enforce certain obvious provisions, but there's stuff even in the part that I think Commissioner Vice Chair Hunter described as the first 75 pages or whatever the overlap was in January, that even have alternatives and some discussion about what we should be doing in response to the court, because the court did not address all of those regulations that are on our books right now. So that was the attempt to try to, you know, continue to move this forward. I agree with Commissioner Weintraub that the language in 104 is critical, and asking questions about it shouldn't bog down the process. This is the first step of the process where we seek public comment. At the end of the day, you know, if there's not agreement on how to deal with it, the commission will address it then. It always has managed to do so. Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I was chair last year, after the Citizens United decision came down last, you know, a year and a half ago, I supported that a rulemaking out of the gates, basically bifurcating a CU rulemaking into kind of two different phases. One, addressing the regulations and statutory, you know, the rules on the books that were directly impacted by Citizens United, and then having a follow-up rulemaking or several, depending on how complex the issues might be, to address other issues that were impacted and that are relevant to the issue but weren't necessarily directly addressed. And the reason why is because, I mean, we do have an obligation to remove regulations that have been invalidated by the Supreme Court, and to comply with that decision, and to provide more clarity on the reporting forms now that corporations and labor unions can engage in independent expenditures. And I advocated that because for fear of where we are now, where we there, as Commissioner Hunter and Commissioner Weintraub pointed out, there's a lot of overlap between the two NPRMs. I mean, if you were to compare word for word, I would say 90% of the document of the two competing documents are identical, and it's on a few sticky issues that they diverge. But those are important issues, and I think we have some different ideas of how those ought to be resolved. But I think that there's a tremendous amount of overlap, and we could get those issues resolved, and I think we have to get those issues resolved in order to be fully compliant with the Supreme Court's dictates. And so that's why I support the approach that's embodied in draft B of the two NPRMs. I would say, though, what that proposal is not exactly novel in terms of what we've done here at the agency. We had a Shays 3 rule, a Shays 3 decision that was handed down right before several of us joined the commission. We didn't have a Shays 3 omnibus rulemaking. We divided that into three discrete issues on coordination and federal election activity and solicitation at non-federal events. I think for the wise reason that any one of those, you didn't want every rule to be bogged down if one rule got bogged down. And so we were able to do that, and all three of those we've promulgated new rules on those issues. And I think that approach, and I hear Commissioner McGann saying the same thing, that I think sequencing is actually important. I think that the more we pile on, the more likely it's going to be that we're going to end up with nothing at the end of the day, and I think that would be unfortunate. I don't want to deny anyone their First Amendment right to ask questions, and for that reason, I'm prepared to support the notices of availability that are on the agenda. One of which deals a little more strictly with the regulations that were struck down by Citizens United, and the second one deals with independent expenditures and is. You know, one that goes beyond the scope of the decision itself. I'm prepared to allow people, you know, to put that notice out, to get comment from the public on the advisability of how to approach the reporting of IEs in a post Citizens United world. So I'm willing to do that. So I'm more than happy to hear what the public has to say. But I do think that in this case, we shouldn't bog down the necessary work of getting the invalid regulations off the books as soon as possible. I mean, I several of us, at least half of us here, have worked up on Capitol Hill, and I think we all understand that we want to attach as much as we can to the vehicle that looks like it's going to pass, and that oftentimes a provision that may struggle to pass on its own, of course, you want to get that on the train that's leaving the station. Unfortunately, if you put too much baggage on that train, it may never leave the station. And so I would support draft B, but in any case, I'm prepared to support the two notices of availability, and when it's appropriate, I'll be happy to vote aye on those.
Commissioner Weintraub?
I've said everything that I can say on this, so I'm ready to make a motion. I don't want to cut off debate, though.
Commissioner Walther? Yeah,
thank you, Madam Chair. It's been an interesting conversation. From my perspective, I think that from the get-go, when we had something as important as Citizens United coming down, it really changed the landscape of everything we do, and most of what we do in one way or another. I was willing to support a plenary hearing just to, without a lot of guidance or restrictions, just to hear what people had to say, what the impact was overall, not to bog ourselves down with the finite questions that we might ask somebody to give an answer to, some of which we already know how we're going to react, but really just sit back and listen to what people have to say, and it might give us some greater wisdom than we're showing here today. The other approach would be to take both of our drafts that we voted on last, and by the way, we did have a cumulative approach toward the draft that we voted on in January, and just agree to send them both out for comment if that's the way it has to be, and hear what the public have to say about those. I mean, we'll get some pretty strong answers one way or the other, but at least we'll get the input. I think what concerns me the most is our unwillingness to listen to other people and what they have to say. Obviously, we can learn a lot from the wisdom of others. It's obvious today. It doesn't mean that we have to vote on everything at the same time. If we have a plenary hearing, we may bite off, okay, let's get rid of the regs that are clearly got to go, and then we've got our hearing, and we've got some guidance here on where we might want to go on this issue, maybe on foreign investment, foreign corporations, which I think is very important now. There's a big hole in the system right now, because before, when corporations couldn't make contributions, it wasn't an issue. Now, when is a corporation a foreign corporation, and when isn't it? Is it a foreign corporation if there's foreigners that run it but owned by Americans, shareholder-wise, by the majority, or vice versa? There's very little guidance of any kind on any of that. So how do we do it when there's foreign corporations and huge investment partnerships, when the general partner is a foreigner but only owns 5%, or vice versa? We need to talk about that, I think, because huge amounts of money can come into the system now without any guidance as to how to identify the foreign money that we're really talking about. So I'd say we ought to put it out, let people hear what people have to say in a lot of this. We do not have, I think, the corner on all the implications that are involved. Today, we have two documents that are before us. I would say that I would support A if it meant a compromise and we could get the votes for it, which we can't. So, I think that we've, in my view, come up with an approach in January, and I would suggest that, that's where I am. I think that was a compromise then in the language that we came up with then. So I think we ought to go back, kind of cool off, and see if we can't figure out a way to ask the public for information, and not worry about whether we have to vote on each particular reg at identical, same time. But let's hear what people have to say before it's too late, and then see what we want to do with the information that we have. I think we could probably work it out fairly quickly if we had an approach like that. But today I see a deadlock, and I'm sorry to see that, but I think that's where we are. I'm glad to see us go forward on the notice of availability, though. I think that's really important for us to do, and I think that will be helpful, too, maybe in our dialogue over these other issues.
Is there any further discussion on the documents? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. All I'll say is I'm willing to keep talking. If there's anybody on the other side who's willing to talk to me, I'm hoping we're not done with this and that we can still try to get this done. But in the interim, I move approval of agenda document 1133.
Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion fails 2-4. Are there any other motions or discussion? Vice Chair Hunter?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I move approval of agenda document 11-33A, which has been referred to today as draft B.
Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Motion fails 3-3. Thank you to Council for
your patience.
Your patience and your feedback on with all of the work that has gone into this. We do appreciate your work on this effort and continuing to help us move this process along. And in that continued effort, the next items on our agenda are draft notices of availability for rulemaking petitions submitted by James Madison Center for Free Speech and the petition filed by Representative Chris Van Hollen. And we will hear from Ms. Helmsley of the General Counsel's Office. Mr. Knopp and Mr. Lutz also assisted on these documents. Please proceed when ready, Council.
Thank you, Chair Bowerly. Commissioners, good morning. The next two agenda items, 11-35 and 11-36, are notices of availability for petitions for rulemaking received by the Commission from the James Madison Center for Free Speech and U.S. Representative Chris Van Hollen, respectively. The notices announce the availability of each petition for public comment. Should the Commission approve the notices, we will take the steps to have them published in the Federal Register. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Council. Our discussion on one or both of the documents? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. I can support these. I have one question I'm trying to find. When was the James Madison Center petition filed?
January 26th.
What year?
2010.
A year and a half ago? Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
And as my colleague knows, we have been attempting to work on a rulemaking, and that is why this petition was not made available, because it has always been incorporated into the drafts, as was reflected in all of the work that we attempted to do last year while Commissioner Peterson was chair. And so, yes, now we are taking action on the petition itself, because we are apparently unable at this point to take action on the NPRM. This was available for the Commission to put out all of last year, but I think we had consensus not to do that while we were trying to work on a rulemaking. So while the Chair last year could have put it out, I think it was – I assume he did not because we were working on a rulemaking to attempt to get that out. So they're both on the agenda today. The second one has come in more recently than the one from the James Madison Center. Is there any further discussion? Are there any motions? Vice Chair Hunter?
Yes, I move to approve agenda document 11-35, and just wanted to note, as it notes in the document and in the cover memo, that this is part of a regulatory procedure whereby if somebody sends in a petition that's properly, that follows all the requirements, that the Commission publish it for public inspection and for statements in support or opposition of the petition to even do a rulemaking. So it doesn't necessarily launch a rulemaking. It just asks the public whether we should whether we should begin one or not.
Is there any discussion on the motion? Commissioner Peterson.
I'll just say the obvious thing that I hope that those out there who review this notice will look at it and give us the feedback that would be very helpful for us. You know, we've been talking a lot today, and we've said we want to hear what others have to say. Well, this does provide a vehicle to hear what others have to say about, I mean, this one, as I mentioned, the first one deals more specifically with Citizens United issues, but the second one also deals with independent expenditures, and look forward to hearing the comments that we receive back.
Commissioner Weintraub?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm happy to support the motion. I had attempted to insert another question into the notice that would say, if we commence a rulemaking, what other issues? Are there other issues that we should consider, and what are they in the context of that rulemaking? But that was crossed out by my colleagues. I was told I wasn't allowed to ask that question either in the context of the notice of availability. So I will just personally issue my appeal from the table that anyone who comments on either of these petitions should feel free to comment fulsomely and address whatever issues you think are raised by the petitions. Thanks.
Any other discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Is there another motion? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a feeling that my colleagues would probably prefer that I make this motion, and I'm happy to do so. I move approval of agenda document number 1136 and direct counsel to publish the notice in the Federal Register and make whatever technical and conforming changes are required.
Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Thank you, counsel. The next matter on our agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2011-09, a request by Facebook by Mark Elias, Jonathan Birkin, and Rebecca Gordon. I believe they are present, and should the Commission have any questions for them, we will ask them to join us at the table. And we will hear from Ms. Selenkoff of the General Counsel's Office.
Thank you, Chair Bowerly. Good morning, Commissioners. You have for consideration three draft advisory opinions that respond to a request submitted by Facebook. Facebook asks whether the small character-limited ads that it sells to political committees qualify for either the small items or impracticable exceptions to the disclaimer requirements of the Act and Commission regulations. The draft and agenda document 11-32 concludes that neither exception applies, but that the disclaimer requirement is satisfied if consistent with the Google advisory opinion. A Facebook ad links to a web page containing a full disclaimer, and both the disclaimer and the Facebook ad are paid for and authorized by the same persons. Draft B in agenda document 1132A concludes that Facebook ads qualify for the impracticable exception from the disclaimer requirements. Draft C in agenda document 1132B concludes that neither exception applies, but that the disclaimer requirement may be satisfied by technological means. The Commission received one comment on the request and nine comments on the drafts. I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, counsel. The discussion on the drafts, questions for our counsel, or any questions for requesters' counsel? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize to my colleagues for popping in and to requester for popping in at the very last minute with a draft C, which I'd like to think might get four votes, but I don't really expect it to. It seems to me that when you talk about small items and what's impractical on the internet, you really The terms of engagement are different. It's a different kind of media than what we're used to. It's not to try and compare the internet ads to pens and buttons. The internet is nothing like pens or buttons. It's got a range of fabulous capabilities that all of the requesters and commenters who asked us to find that the small items and impractical exception apply recognize and tout, and yet when it comes to applying the rules, they say, but just look at it like you would if it were a pen or something that has a very limited number of characters. And it seems to me that talking about character limitations on the internet, it's sort of like talking about font size on the radio. It's just not the right parameter. It's not the way the medium is organized. The way people use the internet, nobody goes to the internet and looks at one page and only one page and then clicks it off and says, I'm done, I've seen everything on the internet. People are constantly interacting with it and clicking on things, and things are popping up. And I meant to bring my phone with me and I forgot, but I actually have the Facebook app on my phone. And some of the commenters talked about What about on phones and apps and, you know, that it's even smaller on the screen? But, you know, my Facebook app on my phone is really smart. I have the sound, the chimes turned off, but it will send me a chime when I get a new Facebook message if I wanted to. When I turn on the phone, I get an immediate pop-up telling me that my daughter poked me. Doesn't sound very friendly, but I'm sure she means it that way. And if I go, you know, into the sort of the home screen on my phone, the little F has little numbers that pop up to tell me, you know, there's one or two or three new communications on my face in my Facebook app right there ready for me. I can go in and look at them. I sometimes get a scroll across the bottom telling me things like my husband likes my status. I guess that's good. So the technology has all these great capabilities, even on the phone app and certainly on the bigger screens on your computer, to provide information. You can roll over, you can, things pop up, you can link to things. And I think at base, when we're talking about how are we going to get adequate disclosure, oh my gosh, we're talking about disclosure again and disclaimers. How are we going to fulfill the statutory mandate to provide disclosure? The internet gives us so many capabilities, and I don't want to shut them off. If we say, well, you know, this, it's a little thing, so you don't have to put the disclaimer on there because you couldn't fit it right in there. But if there's a link in there, or if there's something that pops up when you roll over it, the disclaimer actually is in there. It's just in there in a different way than we're used to thinking about it. So I don't think it's at all impractical to have disclaimers on internet ads. And I don't think we ought to be terribly restrictive about how we how those things appear. We have to be a little bit careful. I don't want to endorse invisible ink. You know, you got to squeeze the lemon juice on it in order to make the disclaimer appear. But this is the way people normally use the internet, is with links and pop-ups and rollovers. And new things are being developed every day that will provide this kind of information or the capability to deliver this kind of information. In fact, we had one commenter who's jumping up and down and waving his arms and saying, I can do it, I can do it. I can give you some new technology that'll get you your disclaimer information out there. So I think we have to be somewhat flexible with this. Several people suggested that we should do a rulemaking, and I think that might be a good idea. I'd be open to that. The last time we did an internet rulemaking, it was a lot of fun. It was very interesting and engaging, a lot more fun than, you know, talking about allocation regulations or affiliation rules or some of the other things that we have to talk about sometimes. So I'd be open to doing that, and I think that then we could address some of the sort of more in-the-weeds issues of, if you have a disclaimer that pops up, how long does it have to pop up for? You know, I'm not attempting to address that in the draft that I put forward. I think, you know, use your common sense. If anybody's going to try and follow this, it has to be up long enough for somebody to read it. It can't be something that pops up and disappears so fast that nobody could actually read the text. But I think, as long as we're flexible, there's lots of ways that the internet can deliver disclaimers, and we ought to encourage that kind of development of the technology and not discourage it by saying, don't even bother, it's not required. The California Fair Political Practices Commission adopted new rules on this after we did and largely followed our rules. They took testimony from a lot of the high-tech folks in California and asked me to testify, too, about what we had done at the FEC, and I was happy to do that. And they basically followed our rules, but they did get a little bit more specific on this issue of disclaimers and said, you know, yes, as long as it's there. You can use rollovers, pop-ups, links, whatever technology is out there to provide the information. It doesn't have to appear the way it would appear in print because it's not a print document. And so I had been uncomfortable with both of the drafts because I thought that draft A was a little bit too rigid, and I became even more so after I read some of the comments, because I agreed that the limitation to the ad had to have the same sponsor as as a page that it would link to and where the full disclaimer would be. I think we can be more flexible than that. If you want to link to somebody else's page, that's fine. Then, you know, you'd have to have some kind of pop-up or rollover technology that would allow the disclaimer on the ad, and then you can link to whatever page you want, and whether there's a disclaimer on that page would depend on the content of that page. What I've put forward, and I, again, apologize for doing it at the last minute, is I think, yes, it says that the exceptions don't apply, but it also encourages innovation and encourages using the capabilities of the Internet to provide the kind of information that the statute requires to be provided so that we can all be better informed and, dare I say, maybe have fun getting better informed. So at the appropriate time, you know, I have no idea whether anybody besides me will vote for it, but I will vote for Draft C.
Any additional discussion? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. What we're talking about is rather small ads on Facebook that political participants might want to buy. And it's an emerging technology. And I hear we want to be flexible, but really some are saying no. So flexibility means no. We want to encourage the development of technology. That means the government's going to tell you how to run your business. That's what I hear. And that's being harsh, and it's being harsh kind of on purpose. And historically, there's been some flexibility on disclaimers. The statute itself recognizes this. The regs have recognized it. AOs have recognized it. MERS have recognized it. Small items and where disclaimers are impracticable is a carve out for the disclaimer requirements. You know, today a bumper sticker, you can actually have a disclaimer that the ink actually no longer runs, and you can actually have it be legible. I mean, one, the reason why you didn't have disclaimers on bumper stickers because the ink would smush. You'd have sort of the union bug squished, and then the disclaimer, and no one could read it, and it looked horrible. And I think the assumption with the small items and the impracticability deal is that people are smart enough to know what they're looking at, and we have to be able to trust people to realize it's a Facebook ad, which doesn't, I don't think, convey a lot of content. That's going to be one of the questions I'm going to have for the requesters. So if Madam Chair, if it's okay for them to start a motion while I warm them up as to what I'm thinking about. Two, I don't think they can just change their technology and do it as easily as we would think, because ultimately it's business. And third, I want to get into impracticability. Yes, there is a commenter that seems to say they can sell you the technology to make this work. There's a lot of other comments saying other things. The one that jumped out to me was Well in Lighthouse, which is a consulting firm that does digital media, including Facebook. They filed the comments through counsel, Bob Linhard. And, you know, he takes head on. His client takes head on the supposed solution of, so long as if you click on the Facebook ad and the page you go to has a disclaimer, well, then that's close enough and that works. The problem is first, what if the ad sends you to somewhere that's not a political committee or not within your control, and you're just sending somebody to a page because that's what you want to do? Does that mean you cannot do a Facebook ad? I guess the answer is you can't. That seems to deny the ability for them to voice their views on Facebook. In addition to that, whether or not the landing page has a disclaimer is a separate issue, as I see it. That's a separate violation if it's a campaign or a political committee. They need to have a disclaimer. If they don't have one, that's a separate deal. And that really is wholly unrelated to them putting an ad on Facebook. I respectfully disagree that the Internet, the analogy with the Internet and the radio, and I think this is a lot like the wireless phone AO, where there was a certain number of characters. And I think this is consistent with what the Commission's done in the past. What I want to do is consistent with what the Commission's done in the past. I think. but I'm not entirely sure because impracticability is a little bit different than impractical. Impractical means you just, you know, can't do it because it doesn't, it's hard. Impracticability is a little bit of a higher standard. I think it's impractical. I think there's impracticability here, but I'd like to ask counsel for his reaction to the discussion specifically. Give me a little bit more as to why this is impracticable from a technology point of view today. If I want to buy an ad on Facebook today, why you can't just do this?
Thank you, Commissioner. I think we need to answer your question, I need to start with from whose perspective. And this is a little bit backwards because I'm here actually on behalf of the vendor as opposed to on behalf of the candidate. If I were here on behalf of the candidate, which is really the perspective from which the regulation is written and from which it should be interpreted. From the campaign standpoint, it is not only impractical, it is impossible, because Facebook doesn't sell rollover ads, period. End of story. Done. It's impossible. Now, the fact that I happen to represent Facebook means we could build a different technology. If I were here on behalf of Ford Motor Company, we could build cars with four bumpers.
Let me ask you about
that. And each bumper could be very big.
Not to interrupt. Are you familiar with all the disclaimers on TV ads that car dealers do, like the lease deal, and they have that whole thing at the bottom of the ad?
I am.
And cigarettes, you have all that stuff about how bad cigarettes are for children and whatnot. Any experience with car dealers or folks putting ads on Facebook? And if so, do they have to put all that stuff on your ads?
Can I invite?
Because that's another agency. That's another regulatory agency, and you know, making sure consumers know what's in their best interest.
The short answer, Commissioner, is yes. The American Motor Companies buy quite a bit of Facebook advertising, and no, they do not include those extensive disclaimers at the bottom of their Facebook ads.
Oh, wow.
So I think to answer your question on the impracticability, it is impracticable. The regulation is talking about the obligation of the campaign or the purchaser to put a disclaimer. From their standpoint, it is entirely impractical. In fact, it is impossible. So from the campaign's perspective, and I don't want to lose sight of this, the thing about advertising on sites like Facebook is that it allows small campaigns an opportunity to get their message out. Big campaigns can spend millions of dollars on television ads. For Joe Jones, who's running for House in some place out in America, for $500 he can take out a Facebook ad and link to ActBlue. If he's a Democrat, he can link to ActBlue. That's it. That's his infrastructure. He's got $500. He's got a message that says, vote for me in my campaign, and it links to ActBlue. You get to ActBlue, ActBlue's got an ActBlue disclaimer, because ActBlue has to have an ActBlue disclaimer. Joe Jones's $500 isn't going to make Facebook stand up and write a new set of code and provide a new option of rollover disclaimers. So the reality of it is either the commission is going to say it is impractical under the regulation for those campaigns, which I believe it is, or else Joe Jones isn't running Facebook ads because, or for that matter, you know, any other ad that would require a similar technology. And it is a shame because, in fact, we will have shut off the ability of small campaigns to operate grassroots activity to raise small dollar donations on the internet. And that's really, frankly, at the end of the day, who suffers if we wind up without this impracticability. I want to take issue with one thing that was said in one of the set of commenters. If you're American Crossroads and you're a 501c4, you don't have disclaimer requirements anyway. They get to run their ads anonymously, with or without this advisory opinion. So the oddity of draft A, and I know it may not be there's a constituency or four votes for draft A, the oddity of draft A is 501c4 is not doing express advocacy because most of these ads aren't express advocacy. They don't have disclaimers anyway. The only people getting punished are going to be the hard money committees. So we're actually going to drive more actors out of hard money committees into undisclosed committees. Disclosure favors, frankly, in my view, draft B. I mean, draft B will make it easier for party committees to operate who disclose. They disclose on their FCC reports they bought Facebook ads. They oftentimes link to their own websites, which have disclaimers. It's going to make it easier for candidate committees to act. They disclose. And frankly, you know, if you make it harder for them, you're just making it, it is another step that I think the commission has taken in the wrong direction.
So. Let me take a step back and ask a larger policy question. There's been a lot of talk about disclosure. And as I understand the purpose of disclosure, it's so the voters have information. If there is not a disclaimer on a Facebook ad, what's really the harm to the voter? Because these ads are not that big. They don't convey a lot of content. They tend to be small, kind of punchy, as I understand it.
They are small.
Right.
And they will oftentimes, and we shouldn't lose sight of this, then it's a point that you made that I think is correct. They will oftentimes actually link to the political committee's website, at which point there is a disclaimer. There's a right. full disclaimer. To the extent they leak, a candidate wants to highlight the fact that a local newspaper has endorsed them, and they link to the newspaper site.
Which doesn't have a disclaimer.
Doesn't have a disclaimer.
So then the campaign can't do that.
Presumably.
And the voter won't necessarily get that information. So it actually could potentially have less information for the voter, meaningful information. Do you see harm to the voter in not having a disclaimer on a Facebook ad? I mean, particularly when you compare it to the fact you don't have to put disclaimers on T-shirts or hats or bumper stickers. I mean, I guess you could do some massive dirty trick campaign with, like, stealth bumper stickers and hide your identity, but that seems so far-fetched, right?
Look, I think the commission...
What's the harm?
Two things. First of all, I don't think there's a harm. Second of all, the commission crossed this in Target Wireless. Mm-hmm. I mean, I honestly don't understand why the cellular phone industry wasn't told, well, just create a technology where you don't, where rather than when you send a text message, it has to link to some other place, and on a smartphone, it would pop up. These same arguments presumably could have been made, and in fact, I think in one of the drafts were considered to be made. And the commission came down in favor of saying 140 or 160, I should know what the limits to text messaging is small item or impractical. And I think from the standpoint of who is the regulated here, which is the campaigns, it is the same here. The campaigns are powerless to do anything other than not buy the ads. If in fact the commission by four votes were to determine that were the case.
Thank you. A general thought maybe for discussion among the commissioners. First, what is the harm to the voter if they don't have a disclaimer? But more importantly, too, and I'm reading again the comments filed by Bob Lenhardt's client, where he says the scope of the decision is limited to its facts, i.e. it only involves ads that have a maximum of 160 characters, a level previously deemed warranting an exception in AO 2002-09, and consequently presents a limited response to a limited question. Is there a concern that there's a slippery slope here and this is going to lead to bigger ads and more carve-outs of disclosure? Because if it's really just limited to the facts of Facebook ads, I'm having trouble seeing what the harm is here. If it's a slippery slope, we could probably carve this in. I mean, I agree with this commenter. I mean, when you look at the exception to the disclaimer, it really is limited to its facts. In theory, somebody else that maybe has 159 characters comes within, you know, Singular Wireless. If somebody else has it, but generally speaking, I don't see a slippery slope here. Is that a concern that's driving the thought, or is there something else that I'm missing?
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if this addresses direct. I think it addresses your question. Let me back up for a second. If we're talking about candidates, I mean, basically, you already know about the Google AO. I know you know about the Google AO that provides that, you know, if the candidate is putting up a Facebook ad, that's going to link to his own website, then, and that website will presumably have a disclaimer on it, He's home free. He's fine. He's golden with that. So, you know, I hear what you're saying about, well, but what if he wants to link to ActBlue? But it seems to me at that point, you know, we're talking about one click or two. So he can link to his own website that's got the disclaimer, and then his website will link to ActBlue if he wants to collect his donations that way. It's not an insurmountable barrier. Every additional click makes it, you know, a little bit less likely that people will do that. But, you know, that's what people do on the Internet. They click on things. I think you've raised a number of issues that are worth considering, you know, would be more appropriate to consider in a rulemaking context, and we'd get, you know, a lot We got actually quite a number of comments here, and that was good. They weren't all on one side. They weren't. Some people actually did not support Draft B.
The lobby for, well, there was one set of comments that came from a reform group that was opposed, and then there was a vendor who wishes to sell technology.
I get that. Okay. I get that. But that doesn't mean the technology doesn't exist. You know, if you're talking about what's impractical, you know, we're not telling you to go out and develop new stuff that doesn't exist. And I think, you know, again, if you look at the Target Wireless AO and compare this to that, you know, that was before any of our times on the commission, and technology moves fast. I'm not sure that Target Wireless would get the same answer today that it got back then, not necessarily because there are different commissioners here, but because technology is, you know, it seems to be a lot more flexible now than it was back then. You know, I'm not sure if they considered all of the, you know, different ways that a disclaimer might have been delivered by text message, because I wasn't here, but I'm quite sure that there are more things today than were available back then, and there will be more things tomorrow and the next day. You know, if we're talking about, you know, candidates and parties, it seems to me that they are most likely to be linking to a page with a disclaimer and would be fine. I hear what you say, that won't always be the case, but like I said, you know, okay, so you add a click, you know, and you get better disclosure and disclaimers. What I think is of more concern to me is that we would be creating for the first time an exception, using one of these exceptions on mass media. You know, the internet has just a much huger potential to reach people, which is why you like it. You know, that's one of its benefits. You can reach a lot of people on the internet in a way that handing out pens just isn't going to get you, right? There's only so many people you can find and hand your pens to. But, you know, the internet, fairly inexpensively, you can reach a whole lot of people. So I think outside of the context of a rulemaking, we ought to be careful of extending exceptions to a mass media like that, a mass medium like that. And I think the what would be of more concern to me than the candidate and the party committees and the way they're likely to use it, and I note that I'm sure this is completely coincidental, but one of the party committees filed a comment represented by one of your partners. What a coincidence.
Actually, three of the party committees filed comments represented by one of my partners.
Okay. Still, quite a coincidence there. But other people could, you know, other people besides candidates and party committees could use these Facebook ads to drive traffic to somebody else's website. And who those people are would not necessarily be apparent.
But they're not currently subject to the disclaimer requirements. That's exactly my concern. My concern is that currently, if you're a 501c4 and you say, read this article about how bad Joe Jones is, okay, it's not express advocacy. There's no disclaimer required under the current FEC regulations. So the only people you're capturing today are to put another small rock on the burden of federally registered political committees. You make the load a little bit lighter for the unregulated and a little bit heavier for the regulated, because the unregulated already don't have disclaimers, and they don't report it. And the folks that do report it now have to click twice or have to go to someone who's trying to sell this or that and add a little bit more expense and burden to it. Not to mention the question of what you do with 441AD. I suppose the party committees can no longer, if there were four votes for draft A, their party committees...
Nobody's voting for draft A that I know of.
Okay,
maybe I'm wrong.
There would no longer be the ability of party committees to spend on these kinds of ads, because if you linked to, if the DSCC or the NRSC or the NRCC took out an ad that said give to Congressman Jones or Senator Jones, and it linked to Senator Jones' contribute page, it would have a wrong disclaimer. If it linked to Act Blue, it would have a wrong disclaimer. If it linked to their own page, then we'd wind up before the commission on a MER that says we're earmarking money through the national party committees to benefit only certain candidates, and that violates the earmark regulations. So there would be, in fact, no more solution to what to do in that circumstance. And I think that the fact is that technology may change, as you suggest it has perhaps for Target Wireless, that in 5 years, the technology is pervasively different. And at that point, you know, it's not impractical. You know, query whether it's still impractical for bumper stickers. I never understood why it was impractical, frankly, for water towers. Someone's going to have to explain to me what it was ever impractical about putting a disclaimer on a big water tower.
I agree with you on that.
I've also, by the way, never seen
it. It was a labor or safety concerns. OSHA, I think.
I've also never actually seen advertising on water tower.
But, well, I guess it's not a problem then.
But be that as it may,
they're tough to paint.
It just seems to me that in the here and now, what you have is a democratizing technology that small campaigns try to use to try to get their message out in an inexpensive fashion. They're reporting it to the FEC. If they're linking to their own website, there is a disclaimer on the website. And the big, bad outside groups aren't covered by this anyway. So we're just the commission faces a choice to squeeze them further. That's policy. Going back to just the law, I am left back where I started, which is from the campaign's perspective, it is impracticable. There is no solution to that for them. It may be that there are technological solutions for the vendors, but for the campaigns, it clearly meets the plain text of the regulation as the regulation is currently written.
I thought you were representing the vendor.
I am.
You said the vendor could do it.
My point is that the fact that that Ford could build a car with four bumpers rather than two and make them really big doesn't mean that campaigns can't rely on the impracticability.
You probably don't want to tell DOT that because they may take you up on it.
I assume the size of the bumper is to make the bigger bumper stickers.
It is both to make a bigger bumper sticker. Or, as an alternative disclaimer, they could put the bumper sticker on one bumper and then have an alternative disclaimer on the side bumper.
Right. And when they have a banner plane, you can have a separate banner for the disclaimer. Right.
Commissioner Weintraub, if I could just respond just with a thought about the mass media point that you were making. I understand the point. I just want to point out the technological difference in the way that Facebook ads work, specific to the facts of our question. Some ads on the internet work where I can buy an ad, for example, on the Washington Post, and every single person that comes to the Washington Post will see that ad. That would be mass media as I think you're describing it today. Facebook ads are actually much more similar to bumper stickers and to buttons than they are to that scenario, in that Mark and myself and yourself could all go to Coca-Cola's Facebook page. And he might see an ad for Steve Israel, and I might see an ad for Senator Cornyn, and you might see an ad for somebody else. The ads are very specific to the people that are viewing them. And so in that sense, the ads are like bumper stickers. They are like campaign buttons in that they are being delivered to people very specifically on an individual level rather than broadcast to anybody who passes by. I mention that just because that our question today is a little bit different than perhaps the question that might be brought by other advertising companies, which do offer more of the you drive by and it doesn't matter who you are, you're seeing this giant message from candidate Y.
I hear what you're saying. But it's not like I'm the only person who's going to see that ad. My ad might be different from your ad, might be different from his ad, but a whole lot of people are going to see all of these ads because, you know, that's the nature of the environment. You don't take it, nobody's going to advertise on Facebook and say, here, I want you to place one ad on Ellen Weintraub's Facebook page, right? No one's going to pay for that, right?
But like campaign buttons, it's not uncommon for us to see campaigns.
You'd advertise for me to support your advisory.
If I could.
But not unlike campaign buttons, it is not at all uncommon on Facebook to see a candidate pay $500 for a very small targeted group. And so to me, that is, I think, a technical distinction than how much advertising works in other parts of both the offline and online world. We are talking generally, our political ads sales don't tend to be multi-million-dollar buys for millions of people. They tend to be $500 increments for the Republicans that live in Blue Springs, Missouri. And that is, I think, in that sense, a little bit different than mass media as it's being imagined here.
Well, I guess it depends on how you're imagining the mass media. Maybe
indeed.
I'm not
indeed.
Imagining mass media the way you're imagining mass media. But, you know, it still seems to me to be very different from a pen or a or a bumper sticker. But, you know, I hear you that it's different. I think you're right. It is different. And that argues for a rulemaking rather than an advisory opinion request, because you can say, oh, this is just about Facebook. But in fact, you know, you've got comments from AOL. You've got comments supporting you from other technological folks who want to use the same. They're going to use this opinion as a precedent. And any Internet ad that's out there, you know, I'm pretty confident my colleagues would say, well, you know, what we said to Facebook has to apply to people who use MySpace, has to apply to people who use, does anybody still use MySpace? I don't know. Has to apply to, you know, whoever develops a new, you know, the next big thing tomorrow. You know, so it's not, I think it's a little bit disingenuous to suggest that we're only talking about Facebook ads.
Well, Commissioner, with all due respect, as you pointed out indirectly, this is not my first rodeo on this topic.
On any topic.
It's true.
I particularly like that in the request you suggested that I invited you to come in and ask this question, as if you need an invitation.
Well,
Mr.
But this, I think, in fairness to Facebook, the posture of how we wind up here is that Google came in for an AO that tried to establish a character delineated impracticability or small items application. And the commission spoke clearly that, and Facebook commented, and the commission spoke clearly, and I was counsel for Google and tried to address relay some of the concerns that Facebook had, and the commission spoke clearly that if Facebook wanted an opinion for Facebook's facts, that Facebook should come in and ask for an opinion. So here Facebook is asking, setting forth its facts and asking for an advisory opinion, and while I would think a second rulemaking on the Internet would be a grand idea. I think I have suggested such in other forums that it would be a great idea. There are today thousands and thousands of ads being placed on the Internet and hundreds or dozens being placed on Facebook, and campaigns are being run today. They are. And I can assure you that they are proceeding under the controlling legal authority that without exception, the practicing bar believes is in place, which is Target Wireless, which is you got 100 and some odd characters, and it's small items. And, you know, here we are with the facts now of Facebook seeking to see whether or not the commission can address the facts here in the way in which it was suggested was not appropriate to do, sort of indirectly through the last advisory opinion.
And I'm prepared to address your facts, just not necessarily in the way you want me to. You know, I'm, you know, because I've got a statute, you know, that says ads are supposed to have disclaimers.
You've got a regulation, Commissioner, and I would love to hear the analysis how it is that this is not impracticable.
I've told you the technology exists to provide this information, and I'm willing to be very flexible about how the information is provided. It doesn't have to be in sort of the traditional, you know, you got to squeeze the entire, you know, paid for by and authorized by into that little box on the Facebook page. But I do think, you know, barring a rulemaking, and I'm willing to reconsider in a rulemaking context, I'm not willing to make that kind of policy decision to exempt Internet ads from disclaimers.
It would be entirely appropriate for you to say that this is your chance to ask me questions, not the reverse. But I am hard-pressed to figure out what would be impracticable. What could technology not solve? What ad is ever impracticable?
I don't know, but the Internet, it seems to me, is particularly good at solving technological problems. That's what we love about it.
I mean,
Commissioner Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, let me thank you for the request that you submitted. I think that it was an excellent request and did an excellent job laying out just how influential of a political tool Facebook has become. That, I mean, almost any candidate worth his or her salt has to have a Facebook presence. And as you pointed out, it's especially an important one for those who are the upstart challengers who don't have the resources to maybe launch the traditional type of media campaign that that more established candidates can. And let me at the same point just thank all those who we received many comments from a variety of different perspectives, and I think that they were all excellent. I certainly appreciate the people who took the time to do that, because I think that they were all well written, well argued, and certainly have contributed a lot of good arguments and a lot of good information on this. The question I have, and the way I'm hearing you state this, is that if Facebook is faced with a choice either to basically modify its technology, its current technology, invest the time, resources, money, whatever it would take to modify its technology in order to comply with a commission dictate that says, well, and you know, these ads don't comply with the disclaimer requirement unless they have some sort of rollover or some other technological enhancement which your technology currently doesn't have, to make that update, I'm assuming would take more time and money than maybe we would just assume offhand. But if you were to choose between doing that to accommodate one small sliver of potential ad buyers on Facebook versus just saying we're just not going to sell ads to basically political committees, if I was hearing you correctly, Mr. Elias, you were saying that that would basically mean that political committees' candidates just wouldn't be able to buy ads on Facebook?
So if the commission issued such an opinion, the obligation obviously would not be on us. And so the regulated community would be the committee's purchasing ads. And so from that perspective, I think it's worth noting it would immediately in this moment disrupt a number of national, local, as in congressional, Senate campaigns, many of whom, including I think all of the major Republican presidential candidates, are running Facebook ads today. So at a minimum, mm-hmm. it would stop in this moment those folks from running Facebook ads. As to what we might do to try to accommodate the market, I simply can't speak to that because we're in the middle of a cycle. And so I honestly don't know how quickly and at what expense. If we have an indefinite period of time to try to iterate and improve our product, we usually try to do so. And we often catch a lot of flack for it in the public, but we try to do so. In this particular case, we have an exceptionally limited amount of time working with a relatively small advertising market. I don't know if we would be able to or be willing to absorb the cost necessary to rewrite our ads platform to accommodate what is a relatively small political ads market in the time necessary to accommodate the 2012 political cycle. Beyond that, I don't know what happens after 2012. I do know, the only thing I know for certain is that all of the campaigns running ads today would have to stop running ads if they didn't want to run afoul of this commission.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. Couple more questions. Let's say there's a Facebook ad that pops up the day after a local newspaper endorses a candidate. You sort of alluded to this, and I was playing with it in my mind, and let me try to tease it out a little bit. So the local paper, let's call it the Shinbone Star, endorses candidate Jones, and the ad says Shinbone Star endorses candidate Jones. And you click on it, and it takes you to the Shinbone Star, and there's the endorsement. Now, if that ad is paid for by the newspaper, no one has any problem with that, I assume. But if it's paid for by candidate Jones, well, that's a problem. So candidate Jones can't buy the same ad the newspaper can buy to drive voters to the same exact content, even though if they purchased the ad, their own disclosure report would show $500 to Facebook. So the public knows they at least paid money to Facebook. Given that Citizens United made clear you can't treat speakers differently, do you think that raises an issue, Mr. Elias?
I'm going to let the commission determine what the extent to which it wants to let constitutional considerations interfere with the statute and the regulations as written.
We don't like to think of them as interfering with the statute.
Fair enough. You're right. In fairness, not
even Paul Ryan smiled.
In not interfering, but that's a balance that commission needs to reach. I will say two things though to your point though. The first is that we wound up, those of us who do not embrace and applaud the Citizens United decision, we wound up there because the commission took an inflexible position that caused litigation to take place that led to a result that, in retrospect, if you asked folks who opposed Citizens United, they would have let them run the movie. They would have said, go make your movie, be done with you, let's not litigate this and turn this into a bigger thing. There, if in fact the commission were to have four votes to come to the place that internet advertising becomes impractical for anyone other than unregulated political committees, the press, and corporate America, then who knows how much all of that nice language about disclosure and disclaimers gets upheld. Because if that becomes the touchstone that effectively acts as a bar against this activity, then it ceases to simply be a let's make sure the public is informed in those places where we can, and it becomes something worse than that. And I would not want to see that happen. I believe in disclosure, and I believe in the important role that it plays in our system. And there is, as I said, an oddity to the way this debate is taking place, where the corporations of America and the unregulated political committees of America are going to be able to run those ads, and the only ones who are not going to be able to are the ones who are playing by the rules that this commission upholds, the Federal Election Campaign Act. And there is a regulation on the books about impracticability that gives this commission an opportunity to avoid exactly the kind of constitutional issues that you raise.
Another question, kind of on the same lines. Let's say a member of Congress introduces a bill. Let's say it's a reform bill. And his campaign does a press release that says, you know, Congressman Jones introduced a bill to clean up the government, you know, whatever the bill says, it doesn't matter. Campaign buys a Facebook ad, and it says, read about Congressman Jones fighting for clean elections or ethics in government or whatever the bill's about. And it links to the campaign. Now, the campaign's going to have a disclaimer, so I think enough of us say, okay, that'll work. But let's say, you know, a think tank or a nonprofit or someone who's not a campaign puts up a press release saying Congressman Jones today introduced a bill to do X, Y, and Z. And let's say Congressman Jones would rather have the people on Facebook be driven to that press release. Right. So the campaign spends $500 to say in that same exact ad that says, you know, Congressman Jones introduces bill. Right. And it links to a press release and say, oh, I don't know, the Campaign Legal Center website. The commenter saying that, you know, we got to really watch this kind of thing. So let's say they're pushing the bill and the campaign wants to drive traffic to their site. They can't because they don't have a disclaimer. That's kind of weird.
That's the scenario I'm addressing. Query whether or not if it would set aside the House and Senate ethics rules, let's assume it's not an incumbent. Let's assume it's a challenger. Challenger wants to say Congressman Jones.
Well, even an incumbent can push, can campaign on legislation they introduced.
Right. But a slightly different hypothetical. They want a link to the official government website. Okay, there'd be issues if an incumbent campaign. But let's say a challenger says, Congressman so-and-so hasn't
done enough. Introduced a bill to silence speech.
Correct.
And they want a link to House.gov.
House.gov. Presumably they couldn't do that unless they could convince House.gov to put a paid for by or some other kind of disclaimer on the official government website.
And that's the problem that the alternate draft doesn't
And it's why I think
address
it's
and doesn't fix.
And it's the reason why it's impractical.
How do we fix that?
It's the reason why it's impracticable. Because from the standpoint of that challenger, what could be more impracticable? I mean, he can't control the website on their landing page, and he can't
control... He can't control the government.
Can't control the government.
Because he's a challenger.
I have a couple questions, and these are out of the blue, so if you either don't know the answer to or you don't think it's in the interest of your company to answer them, I fully understand. Do you know whether Facebook sells ads to candidates in California state races?
Yes, we have.
Okay, so they have, but they have a regulation.
So that regulation actually applies not to candidate committees. I actually was I was invited by that commission to help participate in discussions. We helped develop that language. That language actually only applies to ballot initiatives in the state of California, and then to very specific independent expenditures for exactly the reasons discussed here today. They did not address candidate committees or the party committees that then can run ads on their behalf. Beyond that, California also doesn't have Target Wireless and a couple of other exemptions. But worth noting, the FPPC did try to address these issues, decided to wait until the FEC acted because they were unable to address the issue of candidate committees. I just happened to have been in the room when it was drafted.
Question the wisdom of waiting until the FEC acts.
I question the wisdom of the state of California with some frequency. So.
I guess my question was, so for the ads that they have decided that need the rollover technology, so I assume the people, ballot initiatives are obviously very active in California when, you know, I can't imagine how many are, you know, planned for the next cycle. So for those efforts, those ads are not, so folks cannot buy ads on Facebook? Is that what was happening in California?
So the commission's regulation for ballot initiatives doesn't require rollover technology. It actually very specifically attempted to incorporate technology that was already available, much as we're discussing here today. And so for ballot initiative type campaigns, those ads must link to a page operated by the ballot initiative, which in the case of a ballot initiative is not only, I think, expected behavior, but fairly reasonable behavior. It still doesn't address the scenario that we're talking about here today. Perhaps the San Francisco Chronicle endorses a vote on a ballot measure. That would not be acceptable under the current California regulations. It was an issue we raised in front of that commission, and I believe that that commission actually anticipates revisiting some of those issues because these questions that you're wrestling with today are the same ones they're wrestling with.
And I would hope and assume that if we were to engage in a rulemaking, which I, from my perspective, is something that we should strongly consider, and I'll ask my colleague to do that, because I do think that it's very difficult in the, in this context. We have a statute that says disclaimers are required. We have, we do have some regulations, frankly, ancient regulations in terms of things like bumper stickers and water towers, and adopted in 1995 compared to where we now are now in terms of what the internet does and what it looks like. And while I hear you about Target Wireless, I do think that it's not enough in this area. I mean, that's a very specific and limited usefulness, and I think there's other alternatives that people might want to do. So I don't think this is just this can't be just a policy decision about whether there's harm to voters, because I don't think we really have that flexibility in this instance. My concern is that in this particular case, I think part of this challenge is who's the requester. I agree with you. The committees may not have this option, but they have a requirement that they're supposed to be putting disclaimers on the ads they run on the internet. The reg about running, you know, putting disclaimers on ads on the internet was adopted. Perhaps I was on the commission at the time. I think that was a, shall we say, involved rulemaking. Maybe tackling things like the exceptions was not either brought up or raised or discussed. I don't know, but I think it's something that I would ask my colleagues to consider whether we could maybe not revisit the entire scope of what that is, but in with respect to these exceptions and disclaimers, provide some flexibility where we can still provide the information that's required by the statute, because I think that is the goal here.
And Chairwoman Bauer, if I may, I mean, on behalf of Facebook, we weren't an active political vendor when the first internet rulemaking was undertaken. I think we would be happy to be involved in that kind of rulemaking in the future. What we're looking for clarity on is the fact that President Obama, Mitt Romney, I mean, all of the major campaigns from the congressional level all the way to the very top are running ads today, and they lack clarity. And so we come to request understanding of how they can run ads today. I think that a rulemaking in the future is something that Facebook would be glad to be supportive of, because, as you noted, this is an area that's ever-evolving, and many of the issues, many of the rules that the commission has to work from are now a bit dated based on the technology available.
If I might take a moment for an administrative matter, I'm sorry, I did introduce Mr. Elias and Mr. Burkhan, but we don't have your name for the record.
Sure, my name's Corey Owens, and I'm on the public policy team at Facebook.
Thank you. We appreciate your comments today. We just did not have you as in part of the notice to appear, so we're happy to have you here.
And that's my fault, Chair. I wish to apologize.
Well, that's fine.
Unless he's actually Rebecca Gordon.
I just thought we should not refer to him in our minutes as Mr. Facebook, because that's probably inaccurate. So, Commissioner Walther, I believe you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a few questions. I'd like to just read the fact that this is my ex-party communication. I did talk to Mark Elias this morning. Earlier this morning, I spoke on the phone with Mark Elias, who served as counsel to Facebook in the above-referenced advisory opinion. Mr. Elias and I discussed Facebook's advisory opinion request, as well as both the draft advisory opinions that have been released by the Commission and the comments that have been filed in response to those drafts. I go back to the you remember Watergate, or are you too young? But anyhow,
I read about it.
But not on Facebook.
But I was alive in that sense. I was alive.
Well, let me just tell you. I remember Watergate because the fellow who carried the bag, the infamous bag.
I thought he was asking whether you were there. I wasn't really sure where that was going.
I'm about to tell you how close I was.
That's a great story.
The fellow who carried the infamous bag of money to the phone booth was a classmate of mine in law school. And the next thing I knew, he was before a Senate hearing, talking about disclosure in a different way. But what it basically, we're all here, you know, largely because of Watergate. And the need, a recognized universal need to improve our democratic system by disclosure. Now more than ever, in view of Citizens United, this befalls us to make, I think, extra care that disclosure at least survives. So, you know, we are all novices at the technology that, you know, we're engulfed by. And so I think, you know, it's always catch up for us. If we had this hearing 6 months from now or 6 months ago, some of the things we'd be talking about might be different just because of the way things are happening. But we did get this one comment, and I did want to ask you about the California experience, and thank you for that, because that was of interest to me. I did talk to Mr. Elias today about what happens when a medical company wants to have an ad in the Facebook, and they have some requirements that they have to disclose, and rightfully so, and others may, there may be other parts of the industry, but in order to serve, I mean, just as a public service, the use of Facebook to make medical information available, have you given thought to a way in which they can also provide their disclaimers or whatever they call them in the medical industry, so that the public can get the benefit of the medical industry's ads, but that also allows them to participate in giving the public all the information they need to make a safe decision as to whether or not to buy, you know, life-saving medicines?
So I thank you for the question, because I think it's an interesting example. I think there are obviously differences between sale of pharmaceuticals and political speech, but there's an interesting relationship in terms of how we talk about disclaimers. Facebook, in our terms, would allow a pharmaceutical company to advertise medicines on Facebook so long as they complied with applicable law. As a result, no pharmaceutical companies advertise medicines on Facebook. To the point before, that the regulated entity in this case would be the pharmaceutical companies. We are in a position where, theoretically, I could ask 100 engineers to rewrite our advertising platform so that they could display the lengthy descriptions of conditions treated, side effects, et cetera, et cetera. But we have not, nor has almost any other advertising vendor on the internet. As a result, the pharmaceutical companies don't do much communication about medicines and conditions that people suffer from online because of that particular disclaimer requirement.
Well, I was interested in the comment that was made by this company that you mentioned is in the business here, and I don't know anything about it, but I did find it interesting some of the comments they made about the availability and to provide that. And one fact that was of interest to me was that in May of 2011, you know this better than anybody, there were 700 million users of Facebook.
Our publicly released number is 500 million. But yes, there are many Facebook users.
500 to 700. 500 is the at least the total population of the United States. And so if people want 700, it's almost double that. Now, we have to be careful, it seems to me, about what we say as to how to preserve our democracy when we have an avalanche of new technology. that makes communication available, sometimes not only for the small person, that's very important, but also for those that have huge amounts of money to invest in causing us to form our opinion on who to elect. And when we get to thinking about that, you know, when it comes to disclosure, then I find myself required to pretty much, in an even case, land on the side of disclosure. And that's the issue for me. And I'm not sure, and I think we should have a rulemaking, and I think maybe we should just, because of the way we operate here, it's not very efficient. I guess you've gathered that by now. I know, Mark, you certainly do. We have a little stovepipe approach, and we have a little committee, and if nothing, you know, if it's no white smoke out of the committee, we don't do anything. But I do think we ought to have a little, an agreement, and I would ask the chair, and she wanted to do that, that maybe the open hearing after next hearing is Mr. Colbert. I don't think you're going to want to take that time away from him, but that we should start discussing openly when we will have a hearing on this, because it's so important with the process coming up. And I would hope that Facebook and others, and I see Mike Toner back there, who's been before us and educated us too on the Google matter, will help us figure out how to solve the problem and do it in a way that the democratic ideals can be preserved by giving disclaimers.
And if I can, Commissioner, second what you're saying, in that I think a rulemaking or some other policy statement or whatever, the Commission does all kinds of things nowadays to put out guidance. I think that makes a lot of sense and is past due. I think with respect to the advisory opinion today, the question is what is the status quo in the meantime? And honestly, right now, there are hundreds of campaigns running ads on social media and online, and 0% of them use disclaimers. Zero. Z-E-R-O. Zero. And I would suggest that if the Commission wants to embark in a rulemaking that might alter the universe, including, by the way, some prominent campaigns that Corey mentioned, if that it is better for the Commission, understanding that whatever rulemaking engages in can always overrule the AO, could always change the AO, could always vitiate the AO, that the right place for the Commission to be today is where Draft B is, which is where the entire regulated community. I mean, I look out, it's part of why I snapped a little bit, and I apologize about the comments filed. You've got comments by Democrats, you've got comments by Republicans, you've got comments from competitors of each other in the election law bar. What you don't have is a single comment from anyone who practices in this area that says, oh yeah. I mean, there's one comment that says that they visited a site and they saw a URL on a computer. It's not a disclaimer, it's just a URL. And I think that the right place to put the status quo pending that, I think, very important action is with Draft B. I think if you were to adopt draft one of the other drafts as the status quo, you will cause an enormous amount of disruption in the campaign world. I mean, probably greater disruption than anything this agency has done, at least in my 17 years of practice. So I would urge it that if you want to engage in that dialogue, I would wholeheartedly endorse it, but I would say the status quo ought to be Draft B. The second point I just want to make, Commissioner, is that as of today, Citizens United, the corporation, can run ads without disclaimers. And I agree with you that that is the problem, but that is not a solution that can be fixed by this advisory opinion. This advisory opinion is not going to change that. This advisory opinion is only going to penalize the campaigns and the registered party committees, because by and large, the only way that a corporation gets looped in is if it does express advocacy. And most of these ads don't, frankly, contain express advocacy. And therefore, I share your sentiment both on disclosure and on the need to do something policy, but I think that the status quo should be to agree with the small items allowance.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also, as I said before, I'd be supportive of a hearing. I don't think we can actually pull it off in in a month because we'd have to draft a notice and give people an opportunity to comment and see who wanted to testify, and I think that would probably take us at least a few more weeks than that. But, you know, I'm in favor. Like I said, I like the last Internet rulemaking. I will point out, however, that in that last Internet rulemaking, you know, the reason that we got there was the commission initially said there will be no disclaimers on the Internet. We're exempting the Internet from all public communications, you know, which had more ramifications than just disclaimers. But, you know, we're going to do a total carve-out for the Internet. And there was a lot of sentiment in support of that. However, it got struck down. So, you know, sometimes people who want to have fewer restrictions, those things get struck down by courts, too, sometimes. So, you know, we had to do a rulemaking, and we did, you know, the rulemaking, and we came up with what we thought was a very tailored approach that said the only thing we're going to cover on the Internet are paid advertising on other people's websites. Now, it and it's true, as the chair said, we didn't really talk about the size of the ads when we did that. That rulemaking was, as you know, widely acclaimed. The most popular thing we've ever done, in my experience here, was that rulemaking. Everybody said that's the right line to draw. But a lot of ads on the Internet are small. So I think that potentially, you know, if we were to give you the relief that you ask for today, we would be carving a fairly large hole in that rulemaking and reverting to a substantial degree to the rule that was struck down, which was no disclaimers on the Internet, public communications on the Internet are exempt. And that is why I particularly think that that really needs to be done in a rulemaking context, not in response to an AO. That there are different disclaimer requirements for different entities is not our fault. That's the way the statute is written. And, you know, when you talk about you're placing a bump in the road, the statute requires those disclaimers. We didn't make this stuff up. The statute requires the disclaimers. You're looking for relief from the statutory requirement. And as I said, I'm prepared to be flexible in all kinds of ways, but to carve a big hole in the rule that we already adopted that everybody said was a great rule, I think really needs to be done in a rulemaking and not via an AO. And that's not a question.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, a question of my colleague, and then I have a couple of comments. You mentioned the Internet rulemaking. The disclaimer requirement still applies, but it didn't specifically remove Internet advertising from the scope of the small items and impracticability.
Didn't address it.
So on the one hand, it sounds like under your view of the Internet, those couldn't apply just by theory because it's this, you know, this limitless resource. There's all sorts of technological innovations going on. But on the other hand, that rulemaking specifically left in place the possibility that those exceptions could apply to advertising that's on the Internet. Is that an accurate statement?
Well, I don't know if you can say that something specifically left in place a provision that wasn't in any way addressed in the rulemaking. I mean, it didn't.
It wasn't specifically taken away.
It wasn't taken away.
Therefore, by
it just wasn't,
deduction,
just
it's still
wasn't
there.
Addressed. They exist side by side, and, you know, how one reconciles them, I think, is, you know, what we're talking about here today.
Stay where I am. I support draft B. I think that there's been some mention about the small items and impracticable exceptions being old. You know, they were obviously crafted at a time when technology looked a lot different and advertising techniques were a lot different, but that doesn't make them any less relevant. I think the same considerations that that dictate the size of buttons, that dictate the size of pencils, that dictate the size of bumper stickers, are the same sort of factors that dictate the size of Internet ads on Facebook. I think that there have been some very compelling comments, you know, just one from AOL that was submitted by John Duffy, which says, here the size of the ad is not limited by the technology, but by consumer demand for a particular kind and quality of online experience, which compels many online companies to make online ads placed on certain sites as small as and unobtrusive as possible. And as has been pointed out by Mr. Elias and by Commissioner McGann, I mean, there's a technology that could that could make bigger bumper stickers, that could make bigger buttons, could make bigger pencils. I mean, that's not the issue. We as I think Draft B accurately states, we take the medium as it stands, and as it stands now, the online experience, what consumers demand of their experience on Facebook is that ads be of a certain type. And I think we, because of that, I think that fits comfortably and within the exceptions that are already on the books. And so just because those contemplated something different at the time doesn't mean that they can't be applied when technology evolves. And I think that we need to have that sort of flexible approach here. And again, I'm not even sure if flexibility is really even required. I think it fits squarely within without us having to really stretch the outer parameters of that exception. And on the issue of a rulemaking, I certainly don't oppose a rulemaking. I mean, we've now had basically the same request or something very similar. And I don't know how this one's going to turn out. That one turned out, Google had their, they were permitted to do what they were requesting, but we didn't have an analysis. We had different opinions on the rationale there. So I don't have a problem with the rulemaking, but on the issue of what the status quo is, we can either say, and we've heard from Mr. Owens, and do I have it, that basically if we say that you can't do it under your current system, that means that we're going to have political committees and campaigns as of today who are no longer going to be able to buy ads on Facebook for the foreseeable future. Who knows when we could get a rulemaking done? I think that's a status quo that would be incredibly unfortunate. And especially in light of the fact that I'm aware of no evidence, I've seen nothing that's ever indicated that there's been any sort of fraud, any sort of confusion, any sort of corruption that has resulted from the lack of disclaimers on Facebook ads. And so if we're going to have a rulemaking, I think that the much more prudent course would be to permit these ads to continue to be put up on Facebook in the same manner that they've been put up for several election cycles, or at least I can't remember. I wouldn't know when Facebook became a prime political advertising site, but multiple election cycles. And in the meantime, gather information. If we, in the meantime, gather evidence that there are some problems and that there is confusion, that there is fraud, then in the rulemaking, we need to take those factors into account and craft a rule that accommodates those legitimate concerns with the, you know, with the concerns of making sure that this is an avenue where political candidates and committees can advertise. And I think that would be perfectly appropriate. And if we need to craft the rule to better accommodate the varying interests, I think that would be very appropriate. But in the meantime, I think that, again, without any evidence that there is anything, again, any confusion, corruption, any sort of deception going on because there aren't disclaimers, I think that we should approve the request. I support Draft B. And then I would support moving forward with the rulemaking. Not to step on my colleague, the vice chair is the kind of represents the Republicans on the rulemaking committee. But I hope I'm not jumping the gun. But I think that this is a subject that would be appropriate for rulemaking. But in the meantime, I think that we need to let Facebook continue to advertise as they've been advertising. I think it fits well within the regulatory exceptions that have been provided. And for that reason, I'm going to support Draft B.
Vice Chair Hunter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, support Draft B for all of the same reasons that my colleagues and Mr. Elias has outlined. I won't go through all of those again. But I agree with Commissioner Peterson, and I, too, would be willing to launch a rulemaking on this as soon as possible. I mean, I think a hearing's a good idea. I think a rulemaking's a good idea. I'd be willing to commit to doing that to change the rules post this election cycle and adopt Draft B in the interim.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of things that I forgot to say before. First of all, I just want to make clear to everybody in the world, I am not in favor of larger Facebook ads. I hate Facebook ads, actually. You can make them even smaller, as far as I'm concerned. The fact that other people did not, that people in the election law bar or in some other portion of the bar did not come in and comment saying that, you know, we should have more rather than less regulation is not terribly surprising, because people don't usually pay their lawyers to say, go in and ask for more regulation, that's a good idea, or go in and ask for them to maintain the regulation that's the statute, the Tory provision that's already on the books. You know, people don't pay lawyers to make those kinds of comments. So it's not, that's, you know, I think we get better feedback in the rulemaking context. We usually get a broader base of comments, and you know, certainly in my case, I, you know, put my document out about 2 seconds before we walked into the room, which I apologize for, but, you know, obviously couldn't get any comments on that. The other point I wanted to make is that it's been said repeatedly, and I think it's just inaccurate, that all the political committees are now going to have to take down their ads on Facebook if we don't adopt Draft B. I think that's fundamentally untrue. There is already a path under existing law, under existing AOs, for political committees to run ads on Facebook, and I suspect a lot of them are doing it exactly that way, which is to link to their own websites, and which will have disclaimers. And then those websites can, in whatever prominent way they want, you know, contain inducements to link to other sites. I realize that's not, you know, your preferred approach. You'd like to be able to have the infinite flexibility of, you know, clicking one click from the Facebook ad to whatever site the candidate or the party committee wants to go to. But there is, as I said, it's one click or two. There's a way of doing it. It may not be perfect, but there is a way of doing it. And I think we've tried to indicate that we're willing to be flexible with how the information is delivered, as long as it is delivered, because we think that's what the statute requires.
So any further discussion? Mr. Peterson.
If I can just follow up on the issue of the landing page, I think it's been pointed out by a number of commenters. The landing page option may be a good option if you have a website. Not everyone has a website, and basically upstart candidates and others who want to other committees that may not have a website, now that's going to force them to expend the resources to maintain a website presence. Maybe it's easy for some, maybe it's not easy for others, but it seems like this is something that penalizes, again, upstart challengers, small political committees, that we're going to now say not only do you, you know, in order to advertise on Facebook, you now, as a price for doing that, it's not only the price that you're paying to Facebook to run the ad, it's also the price that you're going to have to pay to maintain a website, whatever, you know, what you're going to have to pay to your internet service provider, to pay a designer to make your website, and so forth. And I think that that could unfairly penalize smaller committees and smaller campaigns.
If I could just respond, I understand that concern. I think that I hear your concern on that, but I think there's a lot of, you know, I don't think we're demanding a full-blown website. In fact, you could link from your Facebook ad to your Facebook page, which Facebook will provide you with an opportunity to put that for free, and you could put your disclaimer on your Facebook page, as many committees already do. Put the full disclaimer right on their Facebook page profile. It's sort of instead of like a status of, you know, obviously married and married doesn't matter to political committees, but it says about, and many political committees, including party committees, include the full disclaimer right on their Facebook page. So I hear the concern, and I think we could all probably come up with, you know, situations where if draft A or C were to be adopted, would be, you know, in make their lives more difficult. But I and those hypotheticals are exactly the sorts of things that I think we would need to try to figure out in a broader forum. I just can't get there in an AO context. So if it's not been clear from my comments, one of the reasons that the language about the Google AO was added to draft A was just to make clear, which is stating the obvious, particularly to Requesters Council, that there are AOs out there that would govern that are valid, and if some a political committee wanted to take advantage of them, they still exist. Now, adding that language to the draft might have actually raised more questions than it answered in terms of what it really means. But I think it was only an attempt to point out, which, as everyone already knows, is Google is out there. It is available. It has 4 votes for the alternative that was presented by that request. It wasn't an attempt to push that alternative onto this requester. It was just stating that Google is, of course, out there. So that's just an explanation of some of the language that was in the draft A that I think, again, may have raised more questions than it answered, and maybe in hindsight we should have just let the obvious be unsaid, which is an existing AO that has four votes governs conduct that falls within it. Is there further discussion? Commissioner Walther?
Yes, I just wanted to, I'm going to support draft C, but I just wanted to say I assumed that the technology would be moving quickly where the money is, like it should. That's understandable, and that there must be a commercial need to provide things like the pop-ups. And just the way I wish I would pay more attention when I'm on my computer. There are times when my mouse will hit something, and I'll get a whole slug of information, whether it's alternate ways to reach a URL or another kind of way to spell a word or other types of things that they think I'm thinking of, books they think I ought to buy. So there must be ways to do it. And I think in terms of the huge, not just politically, which I realize is seasonal, but like the medical community, which to me is very important for everybody to be able to understand what's out there for them. There must be a way to try and help facilitate that. But even if the car companies are the biggest customers of Facebook, I mean, there must be ways in which they would benefit by a pop-up, too, where you could have a novice on my end, but, you know, you might have a national ad says a big deal for this week for Chevrolets, and then the local guy has a pop-up saying where you can find him. There must be a lot of commercial ways that this kind of technology would be helpful, and, I mean, I think it would be helpful, obviously, to the democratic system if it were available. In draft B, I was going to add some language just to make clear what I think was a concern to Commissioner Peterson. Then,
draft.
Let me finish.
Where
the language says other technological means of providing the required information may also be available or developed. And I was to add the essential requirement, in my view, would be implementation of a methodology that provides for contemporaneous display of the required disclaimer information, whether electronically, such as rollovers or pop-ups or other similar means, or in writing, such as a Facebook page or other page on the Internet that is activated by the ad, whether by touching, use of a mouse, viewing, because I guess viewing now can do that, or other means, simply to point out that to me personally, it doesn't make any difference if it hits a page or not. If it's a way for somebody reads it, that's good enough for me. Now, that's just a personal view, and it got dropped out by my Democratic colleagues. But I would be normally inclined to support that type of language. Jesse.
Is there any further discussion?
I have a question.
Mr. Elias has a question.
And the answer may be no, but would the given the late submission of C, we obviously favor draft B, but there has been no opportunity for us or anyone to comment on some. With all due respect, there's now a lot of discussion of technological things. Does the commission believe that it would be appropriate to hold over for further comment in light of the fact that most of the comments have been in favor or opposed to A or B, when in fact it looks like the debate is actually between B or C, and the comments haven't really addressed B or C. I don't know whether that would be useful for the commission.
Can I ask counsel, when is our 60 days on this?
July 5th.
I think. A question, I guess, for my colleagues is do we? We're always happy to hear comments, but if it's not going to result in a different result, then you know perhaps.
I don't think he's asking us. We're on B. Yeah. I think he's trying to convince you off of C to B. So I think you need to look that direction.
There's light on that side of the room. I was just
sunshine.
I fully understood where folks were. I guess it was a question. I understand where the votes are. if there's a consensus to seek comment, despite the fact that we think we know where the votes are and we could conclude this matter today, that's what I'm asking my colleagues about. Commissioner Weintraub.
I'm not sure at the end of the day it would make a difference. And I mean, the information that you provided at the table, you know, I suspect is what would come back to us again in comments. And I think, you know, that's I thought I had a cool solution, right? I thought I had it covered with the rollovers. And what you're telling me is that that's not going to work. And I hear that. But I think getting more comments saying that probably is not going to change the vote at the end of the day. I think, you know, what you're hearing is that several of us think that to do something more extensive would we would feel the need for a rulemaking.
Commissioner McGann?
Even though I said we're all on B, I mean, it's not going to change my vote, but to the extent the requester wants to be able to comment on a draft that some are going to support and wants to make a record in writing as to what they think of the draft and take the issues head on, I certainly don't oppose holding it over. Not going to change my mind, but they may have reasons why they want to make the record, and given that he kind of hinted at holding it over, maybe I ask the requester, is it worth holding it for a couple weeks because you want to do comments, or are you happy where we are?
If it is not going to if there is no prospect for it resulting in a different approach, then no. I raised it only because I know that obviously the commission has had very weighty things on the agenda for today, other than this. Not to suggest, obviously all things before the commission are important, but obviously you've had a lot of things. It's a very busy agenda. You've had a lot of important things. And I knew this draft C originated later in the process than might otherwise be the case. If that, therefore, was going to be a useful exercise for it to be open for there to be comment on it because things might look different or gel differently with the benefit of rumination and further deliberation, then I wanted to make that offer. If that is decidedly not the case, then I think we've made I think the record is clear as to where we stand on behalf of Facebook.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would earlier the impassioned pleas were coming from the other side of the dais, but I'll make my own to see whether or not any of my colleagues would at all be open to at least considering a stripped down yes in this one, a la the way we did it in Google, which was obviously a very unsatisfying way to get to a yes. I think getting to a yes there was important. I mean, obviously, it would be like taking a drink of warm water when you're thirsty, but it would give the requester an answer. And I'm just wondering, would there be any appetite for at least considering that possibility of a stripped down yes?
I think from my perspective, the way we got to the, I guess, stripped down version of yes in Google was that there was an alternative disclaimer offered. And I assume since the same requester's counsel is before us and we do not see an alternative, there is no alternative that this requester would like us to approve. And I think that's the challenge here, is we could make up something perhaps, but I don't think that's really appropriate given that the requester hasn't provided us with what would work for that particular this particular company. Commissioner Hunter.
I have a question for counsel.
Yes.
Does counsel think that anything in the Google AO, the stripped down Google AO, changed Target Wireless in any way?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Weintraub.
I appreciate the offer from Commissioner Peterson. I wish I could think of a way to do that. I just, you know, as it is in C, I try to offer alternative ways of of accommodating the statute and what requesters wanted to do, but they haven't actually suggested that they want to do any of those things or that they could do any of those things. So you look like you're leaning forward into the mic, Mr. Elias. Do you have a suggestion?
That's why I asked the question. I'm picking up a little bit on the point that you're making and that Commissioner Peterson made, which is that, and I'm not, this is, again, I'm not complaining about this, but we walked in this morning, got a new draft. To the extent that it reflects an effort, and I'm not trying to characterize this, but it reflects an effort to try to move one side, the other side, a third side, whatever, to something that would be some form of yes with various reasons, would it benefit from further deliberations of even a day? You know, wouldn't have to necessarily be a hearing again. You know, maybe you have to under your rules, but you know, would it? Is there? You seem to lay on the table a series of possibilities. I don't know whether those are the only possibilities. They are not obviously possibilities that came from us.
They were not intended to be the only possibilities. I guess my question back to you is, I would be happy to give you the opportunity to try and come up with a suggestion that you think might, you know, I can't see it sitting here. I can't figure out how to do what we did in Google. I would like to do that. I'm always looking for a way to say yes with four votes if we can, but I'm not personally seeing that. You know, if you think you're just going to repeat on paper what you've told us here today, I think that's probably not going to move anybody anywhere else other than where they already are. But if you think, you know, given 24 or 48 hours, you know, you could come up with some brilliant inspiration for how we could, you know, kind of meld the two approaches, I'd be willing to listen to it.
Did you want to provide a response? Otherwise, I think Commissioner Walther wanted to.
No, hurry. Go ahead.
Okay.
I don't know. You know, I don't know. There were a series of, I think, three questions we posed at the end of our comments that I guess I would want to understand how whatever view, whatever, to take the experience of last time where there was a yes with then multiple opinions. I think if I understood, it would be helpful to understand, though, for example, what do you do with Party 441AD? What does C contemplate a well?
I apologize. I didn't mean to smirk or interrupt you, but I think getting a consensus of four and what 441AD means is might be more than we're up for in at this moment in time.
Okay.
I didn't mean to interrupt your answer, but what I think I hear you saying is there are questions that you would, if we were to try to do a streamlined yes, as Commissioner Peterson is proposed, there are still questions that you would want answered to be useful to this requester. Am I paraphrasing what you were trying to say correctly?
Yes, or there might be further accommodations. For example, I don't mean to suggest that I've heard anything today to say that this is going to be the case, but one or more of the commissioners might determine that, for example, in the case of Party 440D expenditures, it is impracticable. That they can get to yes on that, right? That might be. I don't know. Maybe the answer is no. There isn't. We have reached a complete impasse in the Google experience. We started at impasse. We had another round of comments, and then there seemed to be a way to get to at least some consensus position. I just I I don't know whether that is complete futility here or not, because I don't know the extent to which the late draft represents kind of the final explication of how, of what other than a paid for by X party, www.xparty.com, and not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee in a box, right? How you see represents some movement from there, right? Not to be, but some movement from there. I don't know whether there is any other places of potential movement in C that might yield some agreement or compromise, at least on some pieces of an outcome.
Commissioner Weintraub.
I think, yeah, I was taking a quick look at these questions at the end of your comment, and I think actually C does address some of them, if not all of them. You know, fundamentally what C says is any way you can provide this information, you know, it doesn't have to be squished into that same little box. Any way you can provide the information, as long as you provide the information, that'll work.
So let me give you sort of two hypotheticals.
Okay.
One is, clearly in the case of political committees linking to their own website, the answer to that would seem to be yes, right?
And I think that's already covered by Google.
Okay,
that's
but
easy. Yes.
But it's still, you know, it may be the every journey begins with a single step. Right?
Yes, I'm happy to be able to say, you know, yes to something to you, Mr.
If a Wise. if a party committee is reflecting on their FEC report that they made a coordinated party expenditure with a payment to Facebook, does that do enough? I mean, maybe the answer is no, but I guess
that
what
might
I'm
be a little too attenuated.
Okay, but this is my point, is I don't know the extent to which C represents, you know, whether there is a way to try to, on at least some of these questions, move closer, even if in the end there won't be a yes. There may be deadlock on pieces, but there may be a way to get to some greater clarity for the regulated. I don't know.
I think, from my perspective, I think it's difficult because I think we all at different times remind ourselves that the goal here is to answer the question that's been asked by the requester. And the question that was asked was, do these exemptions apply? And I think, as I mentioned earlier, I think draft A and an attempt in draft C is to state again that Google is out there and if that complies, and I support Commissioner Weintraub's efforts to basically say that if you can provide a disclaimer in a readable, usable way, but that's not in the little box, either in a rollover or in some other way that exists. And again, I don't think without suggesting that has to be the way Facebook or any other company develops that, but to sort of state that kind of flexibility, as long as it's still there. But I think from the challenge is that some of us think the disclaimer requirement applies and some of us don't. So it's in Google, it was easier to come to a stripped down yes because there was an alternative disclaimer provided in the request. So it's not clear to me that possibility exists here. That's my view.
Yeah, I'm not seeing where else this would go that would be of benefit to you. I'm just not seeing how to get there.
Commissioner Walther.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a hard time saying no to more information, but I'm not sure. In your own minds, you can hear us rattling around trying to learn as much as we can about what the options are or how it could be done, and if in your own mind you think we could benefit by anything, then I think we ought to try and, you know, be open to that. Now I know that the issue, and I think my language was dropped, as I understand it, from the draft C, because it, you know, appeared like we were into the rulemaking business, and it may, you know, I think as you approach this, it may even look like that even more so, if we were trying to, you know, craft something new that's out of the parameters of a request already. But on the other hand, I guess we just have to face that when it came to it. So I wouldn't say no to more information. I think it would be helpful. I mean, you'd have to scratch your head and see if you could help us along the way there, because right now we're operating on, you know, a request. What we've got, you know, our own preconceived notions of where we ought to go, and so I don't know if it would be helpful. I wouldn't want to set up an expectancy that something great would come from it, but I don't know.
Is there any further discussion?
So your thought would be, what were you thinking then? I noticed that there's kind of a back and forth in your own mind about what, how to respond to this. Or not. Is this a morass you want to just get the vote over with?
Is it possible to consult for 5 minutes? And
sure. Why don't we take a 5-minute break? Everyone could probably use that. We'll come back to order 5 minutes after we took a little break.
Not a bad guy.
Yeah.
He'll be on your side.
Is there any further discussion on these drafts, or are we ready for motions? Was there? Did we have a question pending? But I think Mr. Elias had asked for a moment to consult.
Right.
And that was in response to someone's question about. Was this in response to your question, Commissioner Weintraub?
Why don't we just say this? Do you have anything that further that you'd like to communicate with us after consultation with your client?
Absent any conversations that you all have had among yourselves, it appears you're likely to deadlock, which I think will be unfortunate. We believe that Target Wireless remains absent an affirmative vote of four commissioners. Target Wireless remains controlling, and we believe that it will be relied on by the regulated community. So we don't need any, so we're not asking for further time unless the commissioners themselves believe that there is a compromise or something that can be reached.
Any discussion by commissioners? Is there a motion? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move approval of draft C.
Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion fails 3-3. Is there another? Commissioner, Vice Chair Hunter.
I move agenda document 11-32-A, which has been referred to today as draft B.
Is there any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No. Motion fails 3-3. We will ask counsel's office to send a letter to requester indicating what they already know, that there's the commission will not be able to provide an answer on the request. The next matter on our agenda is draft advisory opinion 2011-08, American Society for Anesthesiologists, presented by Glenn Willard. Commissioner McGann is recused from this matter. And we will hear from Ms. Helmsley from the General Counsel's office. Please proceed when ready.
Thank you, Chair Bowerly. The American Society of Anesthesiologists, or ASA, requested the advisory opinion before you in Agenda Document 11-30. The request asks whether ASA, an incorporated 501c6 organization, may solicit its retired and life members for contributions to its separate segregated fund. The draft first concludes that ASA is a membership organization under the Act and Commission regulations. The draft further determines that both retired and life members are members for the purposes of the Act and Commission regulations, and accordingly, ASA may solicit both groups for contributions to its separate segregated fund. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Is there any discussion on the draft or questions for our counsel or counsel for requester? Is there a motion?
I move agenda document number 11-30.
Is there any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 5-0. Thank you, Ms. Helmsley. The next item on our agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2011-10, Poet LLC, Poet Pack, and Sioux River Ethanol LLC, represented by their counsel, Mr. Toner, former Chair Toner. And should the Commission have any questions for you, we will ask you to join us at the table. Mr. Bloom in our counsel's office will present the advisory opinion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Agenda document number 11-31 is a draft response to a request for an advisory opinion from Poet Pack, a non-connected committee, Poet LLC, and Sioux River Ethanol LLC, which is one of 27 Poet plants. The requesters specialize in the production and refinement of ethanol from corn bought from corn farmers. The requesters ask whether they may establish a program, the Poet Pack Cultivator Club, for soliciting contributions from the corn farmers to Poet Pack. Sales contracts would contain added solicitation language as well as all applicable disclaimers. If the corn farmers agree to contribute, they would do so by authorizing the Poet plants to deduct a portion of the amount due to them as payment for their corn and to transmit this amount directly to Poet Pack. The draft concludes that the requester's plan is permissible under the Act and Commission regulations. The draft further concludes that the proposed placement of the disclaimers, the disclaimer language, and the requester's proposal to adjust Poet Pack's advance payments to the Poet plants on a quarterly basis are permissible. We received one comment on the draft from the requester that made certain factual clarifications. First, the requester clarified that not all the Poet plants plan to participate in the Cultivator Club. Specifically, the requester states that only 25 of the 27 Poet plants plan to participate in the Cultivator Club. Second, the requester clarified that the Poet Pack will pay advance compensation every month rather than every 2 weeks. We do not believe that these factual clarifications affect the analysis or the conclusion of the draft. It will be necessary, however, to amend the draft in order to take account of them. Accordingly, we propose to modify the draft as follows. Throughout the draft, we would modify the description of the Poet plants to match the description provided in the comment and to clarify at certain places throughout the draft that its analysis and conclusions apply only to the Poet plants that are actually participating in the Cultivator Club. For example, at page 1, line 25, we would replace the sentence, "The Poet plants are organized as partnerships under the laws of the several states where they are based, with 24 of the 27 Poet plants are limited liability companies that have elected treatment as partnerships for taxation purposes, and one Poet plant is a limited liability partnership. Of the remaining two Poet plants, one is a corporation and the other is a cooperative that has elected treatment as a corporation for taxation purposes." On page 2, line 14, after the phrase, "Poet plants," we propose to insert the phrase, "that plan to participate in the Poet Pack Cultivator Club, known as the Participating Poet Plants," and insert a footnote stating, "only the 24 Poet plants that are LLCs treated as partnerships and the single Poet plant, that is a limited liability partnership, will participate in the Cultivator Club. The remaining two Poet plants, one of which is a corporation and the other of which is treated as such for tax purposes, will not participate." Throughout the rest of the draft, we would replace the phrase poet plants with participating poet plants to make it clear that we were referring only to the 25 of 27 plants that are actually planning to participate in the Poet Pack Cultivator Club. On page 4, line 17, that's line 17 rather than line 18, we would replace the phrase "every 2 weeks" with the phrase "every month." Finally, on page 6, line 3 and following, we would replace the sentence, "here the Poet plants are limited liability companies that are organized as partnerships in the states in which they are located," with the sentence, "here the participating Poet plants are limited liability companies that have elected treatment as partnerships for tax purposes and one limited liability partnership." We would request that, if the draft response is approved, such approval include the incorporation of these changes. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions or discussion of the draft? Commissioner Weintraub.
I have one question for my former colleague.
Mr. Toner, will you please join us at the table?
I just got to ask, where does the name come from? Are these verse-writing corn farmers? I mean, the Poet Pack Cultivator Club, it's very alliterative. What...
I'm just excited, Commissioner, not to be talking about online advertising and Citizens United. Anything else but those subjects.
This is an easy one.
My colleague, Mr. Kobus, probably undoubtedly has a deep knowledge of the history of the Poet name. Please join us.
I thought it was a simple question.
It's far more interesting than the impracticability exemption and disclaimers and all that. Please,
if you could Kobus. Please tell us your name for the record and your affiliation.
Sure. My name is Jonathan Kobus. I'm counsel for Poet LLC. Most people think it's an acronym. It's not.
I noted that. That's why
it came from the creative minds in our management team, actually. They wanted to articulate the kind of agricultural creativity that went into the product. So we changed our name from Broin Company several years ago to Poet. And it's capitalized, and it's very confusing to many people, but we like it. So many people think I'm actually a poet, as in a writer, which I am not. So
I'm disappointed to hear that. You could have submitted it in free verse, you know, your request. That's all I got. Thank you.
Anything else on the request or names of requesters? Ethanol is poetry. Hadn't really thought about it that way. Is there a motion? Vice Chair Hunter.
I move to adopt agenda document number 11-31 with the edits as described by council. Thank you.
Is there any discussion at the table? Any discussion of the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 6-0. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, council.
I hope it was worth the wait.
Absolutely.
Do you want to talk with Matt? Okay, thank you. The next item on our agenda is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the United Association Political Education Committee. We have Mr. Stoltz from our Audit Division joining us. Please proceed when ready.
And I had anticipated reinforcements. But
they all went out to lunch.
I thought they were right behind me.
Way behind.
Shall we wait for them?
Well, I think we can get started. The Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on United Association Political Education Committee, we talk about three issues. Excessive contributions that the committee apparently made to various candidates, having some problems tracking what their affiliates were doing in addition to what they were doing. An issue relating to the filing of 48-hour notices for independent expenditures. And this is a situation where these independent expenditures were not what we usually deal with, media and that sort of thing, but rather signs and hats and T-shirts and all those sorts of things. And the question of dissemination date came up. Most of the 48-hour notices on these were filed and the bills were paid after the election, which we sort of doubt was within 48 hours of distribution. But there's really no record on precisely when this stuff made it to public view. What the committee has done, and we think is a reasonable solution, is in the future they are willing to file the notices as of when they receive such materials from their vendors. And that would get it on the record most likely early, rather than try to figure out when all the locals pass the stuff around. The third issue had to do with some transfers back and forth to their locals and the way they reported those, and those have been amended, and I don't think there's much else to say about them. So with that, I would be more than happy, or we would be more than happy, to take questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Commissioner McGann.
I don't really have questions, but to cut to the chase, the issue I have is exactly what Mr. Stoltz talked about, which is when they report, I guess in this case it's yard signs or things like yard signs as IEs. It's tough for me to vote for an audit to make a finding that these folks failed to do independent expenditure reports when we really aren't sure when those reports were due. And I guess you could say, well, they should know when they handed the signs out to the public, it's their fault. On the other hand, it's not particularly clear, and that there's different ways and different approaches that are being suggested tells me the rule isn't particularly clear. Regardless of what we do in this audit, though, we need to make sure that if it is, if it this does become a new way of doing things, the public is made aware, particularly other unions, and that this is not just something that ends up buried in an audit report, because someone else will stumble on this same issue. Now, what is the rule? Well, the general rule is you do an IE report within a certain time period after the communication is disseminated to the public. Signs are a little bit tricky because, one, there's a lot of them and people hand them out, sometimes volunteers and whatnot, so it's tough for those handing out the signs to necessarily incur the burden of trying to keep track of all that. So I think the auditors and the counsel's office tried to come up with a workable solution, which I think is a good idea, but I'm not sure that it's the right solution in a couple different ways. It's suggested that they could use the date that the national receives materials from the vendors. The problem with that is, well, it's not public, right? So that's not really an IE because no one knows about it yet, so that's not really consistent with the rule. And two, what if they decide to use the signs as restricted class communications and then later they decide to use them as IEs? You could see that happening where they're not really sure how they're going to use the signs. They just use them as needed. So I'm not sure that date works because they may never end up being IEs, or they may become IEs long after that date. Another suggestion is the date when the local makes when the union makes them available to its members of the restricted class. That raises the same kind of issue. Who knows if that's public? Maybe it's when the national ships it to the local. That has other problems. So I objected and brought this to the table to maybe discuss this, because a lot of folks probably don't think yard signs would require IEs anyway, but, well, if they're express advocacy and they come within the rules, I guess they do require reports. Be odd to think that bumper stickers would require IE reports when they don't require disclaimers, not to go back and go through it. There's no small items or impracticability exception, I guess, for IE reports. But without taking up a lot of time, since we're through the lunch hour, and I take up as much time as we want to take up, but it seems to me this is an issue that's going to come up. It's kind of union-specific. I don't really see this happening elsewhere. Party committees tend to buy their own signs, and they don't necessarily have the restricted class kind of thing. But I'd hate to see another union be doing it differently, or not do an IE report or do a different date, because the idea is that the rules should apply to similarly situated folks the same way. And I don't know where to go from here, because on the one hand, yes, they should have done an IE report, but on the other hand, we don't know really when that was due. And again, like I said, it could be their fault because they didn't write it all down, but is that really what the IE reporting regime contemplates, keeping track of when you hand out particular yard signs? That doesn't make sense either. So there's no good solution here. Maybe others are fine with when the national receives it from the vendors, but the downside there, as I addressed, is that could cause problems. You know, it's a start, and I thank council and then the auditors for at least starting us down the road. But to create a new rule essentially in an audit gets tricky, because it's tricky for this committee to then would have a finding they did something wrong. And then it's tricky for the next folks to figure out, oh, in some audit it's buried that when you're supposed to do this. So that's why I brought it to the table and taking up time, and we don't have to decide it today. Although today, one way to solve it is to put this in the other issues section and not actually make it a finding and say they should have done IE reports, but there was some we can put a passive voice, some confusion as to when it was due because of the nature of the communications and that kind of thing. We don't have to say, because the rule was clear, we just make it passive, so we're not really saying who's at fault, and at least move it along if we want to move this union along, and at least conclude the audit. But this is an issue that I think we need to address at some point in the not-too-distant future, because maybe people are just not doing IE reports at all. Maybe they're not calling them IEs. I guess these folks reported them as IEs after the election using the invoice date.
Of the 510,000, 324,000 were reported in December and when they paid it.
And they could have showed these as general overhead. Unless you happen to find a copy of the sign, you would have never known.
Looking at the invoice, you have a pretty good idea. plus they reported, maybe this invoice. Plus they reported them.
Right, but I'm saying if they didn't report them as an IE and the invoice didn't specify yard signs that contain express advocacy, and they just another union could show it as just general overhead, no way you would know.
You may not know.
And these guys actually tried to disclose, and they're in more trouble than maybe somebody who just says, well, we weren't sure if those were restricted class or what. This has come up in another context with shipping signs to unions, I think, somewhat recently.
2004 cycle with Drive.
Okay.
And there the debate was not what the dissemination date was. It was, were some of these items restricted class only type things, and were some of them not? And
right.
The commission chose some were and some weren't. But they had filed no 24, 48-hour reports, and so we were pretty sure that they weren't timely, and the date never really came up in discussion.
I think procedurally, in response to what Commissioner McGann said, I think procedurally that would be accurate. If there are not four votes to adopt any one of the three findings, then it would, when on the audit division drafts the next version of the report, it would go to the additional issue section. If there's a way to clarify this in a way that we can achieve some consensus and put out a policy statement or something to the effect that would provide the public more notice about this, I'd be supportive of that effort. I hear your point about if it just goes to another office, it's not really for public consumption at that point. But I think the challenge is it can't be the payment date, and that's what they used here. And that's the reason that I think, the finding is from my perspective is accurate here, because it's certainly not the payment date. I hear the challenge in terms of when things are transmitted from different layers of an organization or passed along in a certain way. Maybe there's a bulk order for something and things are spread around to different folks, that there might be some there might be more than one date that is the triggering date for the report, but it's never the payment date. So that's the real challenge, I think, in this particular audit. But I think you're right. There's a broader question that we should try to answer if possible. I think counsel's office has tried to provide some options in terms of when the appropriate date might be.
If I could. It could be the payment date if they happen to be the data they disseminated it.
If those coincided.
Right, it was just a coincidence. I'm not saying any of the suggestions by counsel are necessarily wrong, because we're essentially creating an application of a rule to meet unique circumstances. I think we need maybe some more options. I'm glad you mentioned a policy statement. Maybe we could do that. Maybe something interim. Maybe, I mean, we could talk rulemaking, but that takes forever and a day, and this is rather a sui generis kind of thing. And although some policies go out for comments, some don't, I would suggest maybe this does, at least briefly, because I don't know how unions ship around their yard signs. I can kind of guess, but somebody may come in and actually explain this to us in a way that gives us some more ideas and actually is more consistent with the reg. But I think going into this cycle, it makes sense that they know when their reporting obligations occur, and at least they have some sort of say. And what we do with these folks is a different question, but I'm glad that maybe there's some appetite to at least give these folks some guidance without having to do a whole, rulemaking to change a rule that otherwise is works in most applications on, pretty well. It's just something for these kinds of folks.
Commissioner Peterson, and then I know Commissioner Walther wanted to leave.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question, a factual clarification. I'm assuming this union has done this sort of thing in the past, and in the course of the audit, did they ever mention how they had reported these in the past? Have they always used the payment date in the past? Have they used some other date? What information did you gather with regard to past practices? Yeah,
when we discussed it at the EXA conference, their concerns were, yes, we know we have to file the 24, 48-hour notices. We have no idea when dissemination is with respect to materials and the type of independent expenditures we're talking about here. They haven't received RFAIs, especially in this case when they reported the independent expenditures in December. If you do pay for it in December, technically you're supposed to report in a memo entry on the date disseminated, as well as the debt. And then when you pay it, you report the independent expenditure and pay and report paying off the debt. So I think they've always had the issue with dissemination. They've always filed the reports with the independent expenditures being the date they paid.
Okay, even though it would have probably been outside the scope of the audit, do we know, have they had problems sending out their 24 and 48-hour reports in the past?
Prior to the audit, I don't believe we know.
Do we know? Okay. I was just wondering if we knew about how, I mean, has this been something that's been kind of going on and on, and they just, because they didn't know how to identify when the date of dissemination, have they always basically failed to file their 24 and 48-hour reports because of that confusion? But sounds like we don't know for sure exactly on that, so that's all I have.
Commissioner Walther?
I'm wondering if we just shouldn't put it in the additional issues section and then try and figure out the policy and maybe get some comment on it.
Commissioner Weintraub?
Move it along.
I am happy to engage in the exercise of trying to clarify this, issue a policy statement or whatever. I also had some concerns about that particular issue, although not necessarily the same concerns as my colleague. I was wondering whether there was a potential reporting hole being created, if it's more than 1,000 but less than 10,000 and it comes in, too late for the 48 hours and too late for the pre-election report, but it's too early for the 20-day, for the 24 hours. There could be like this little window where they don't report it before the election because if they were to adopt this policy of using the earliest dissemination date, that doesn't always result in more and earlier disclosure.
That's a gap.
Yeah, Sam Brown came up with that one. Clever man. I'm not even going to touch that. I sort of was concerned about that, whether there was this potential reporting hole that maybe made that not a good date to use. But, on reflection, I think they've got to use some date that's administrable. And if that's the most administrable date, the odds of that particular hole occurring seem to be relatively slight. I'm not suggesting that anybody would try and manipulate it so they get, $19,000 worth of material, 21 days out and don't get the extra $1,000 until 19 days out so that they just avoid the $20,000 trigger. Is it a $10,000 trigger? Anyway, there's a way of doing it. There's a way you could manipulate it to avoid reporting. And I'm not suggesting that anybody would do that, but it could accidentally happen. It just probably wouldn't happen frequently enough for me to get too bent out of shape about. I think maybe using the date of distribution to the member organizations, to the member unions might be, because it would be closer to the actual dissemination date to the members of the union, might be more accurate, but maybe less administrable. I suspect that actually figuring out when they give out every single yard sign would be completely unadministrable. But I think I would be willing to support the finding because, as the chair said, there's a lot of ways they could have cut this to try and get the information on the public record in advance of the election. And I think that if they had come up with some theory that would have, by which they did report it before the election, my guess is that our auditors probably would have said, all right, that's good enough. The fact that they chose, the one date that we're pretty sure is not the appropriate date, and that resulted in reporting after the election, makes me comfortable with approving the finding. If there aren't four votes for it, there aren't four votes for it. I won't get a lot of heartburn over it.
Commissioner McGann.
The finding itself, I started by saying I couldn't support a finding that said, they did something wrong. The finding really doesn't say that. The finding says that they comply with the auditor's recommendations, and it kind of leaves for another day or doesn't spell out what really happened. Could we perhaps adapt the proposed finding as is, but then in the other issue section, say the commission agreed to, you know, issue a policy statement regarding independent expenditure reports, you know, they're contemplated in finding two for small, for the yard signs and that kind of thing. It just puts something in the audit report that at least we lock ourselves in that we're going to do it. Because right now, if the public, if we adopt this today and the public reads it, they're really not going to know what happened, and the next guy's going to get caught up. And since it's fresh, maybe we can drop something in that says, say somebody happens to read this, they know there's something else to read somewhere else.
I guess my only...
That's the best way to do it. It's just one
suggestion. I think that obviously, even if we adopt this today, this audit report has got a couple of phases of the process to go through. It seems to me that it's not clear. You know, we have identified this other issues as an area where there hasn't been necessarily a full agreement of the commission or et cetera. But I would fully support putting in the text that the issues raised in this audit and noted in the council's memorandum, the commission intends to further explore and explain to the public what should be done somewhere. I guess I'm not exactly sure where it goes, but I'm certain that we can come up with an appropriate place for it. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm comfortable with, you know, putting that in the report somewhere. I do feel obliged to point out that the finding does say that they failed to timely file their 24-hour or 48-hour notices of their independent expenditure. It does actually say that. So, you know, if you're not comfortable, in all honesty, if you're not comfortable saying that, I wouldn't want you to be voting for the finding under false pretenses, thinking that it doesn't actually say that, that all it says is they're going to comply with audit recommendations.
But I think, well, I guess as I read it, there was the discussion of the interim audit report is that UAPEC basically agreed to, you know, develop a new policy to track, which is, I think, what is the, it's you know, since there are no, they can't go back and amend the reports, they can't have something to materially correct the record in because of amended reports because they don't have the information. But in lieu of that, they seem to be saying we will be taking additional steps. Mr. Nerthen,
just wanted to add, the next stage to propose final audit report will pick up from the draft final audit report, which does say they didn't file the notices and which does say that they incorrectly reported independent expenditures that were disclosed after the election. That proposed report will then pick up with the committee's response. So you'll have the whole picture in the proposed report.
Is everyone comfortable? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you for that. First, well, they didn't file IE reports, and that's fine. Two, the interim discussion that they agreed to implement revised procedures, that's really the question, what procedures are there? And three, this is coming back around, and maybe that'll flesh out, but I think we need to be the ones to tell them what the revised procedures are. And what I'm saying is that the suggestions that are on the table work, but there's probably others, and they may not work in all cases. And you brought up a great one about the gap. So however we want to do it, we can move this along now. Okay. But it'd be nice to have something attached to this or something that we're going to do a little more.
So we would approve the recommendation memorandum with the and request that in the next draft of this report that the audit division include a statement that the commission intends to consider these issues with respect to IE reporting and make a public statement with respect to that. Is that sufficient?
Sure. That'd be great. Maybe if we hustle, we can actually have that working draft in place before this comes back to us. No, not you. Maybe we can get our working draft on the procedures.
The proposed should go pretty fast.
We can. Okay. The more process is amazing.
I'll bet a soda.
You doubt us?
No, but I will bet a soda.
Anything further?
We can move when we want to move.
Would someone like to move, in fact? Commissioner Weintraub.
So moved, Madam Chair. But before we do this, I have one more question for Mr. Stoltz. Mr. Stoltz, I know we're having your retirement party next week. Is this your final appearance at a public meeting?
It could well be.
It could well be. Well, I would not want that moment to pass without expressing my sincere and deep thanks for your extraordinary service to the community at large, to the FEC, you know, We say, I think we built the building around you, Joe. You know, you were here before the agency was here, and no one has served with more honor and distinction and integrity and devotion to the mission of this agency than you have. So thank you. And I will tell you again next week, but, you know, bon voyage and have a great retirement.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's been quite a run, and I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Remarkable.
That's remarkable that you wouldn't trade it, but it has been it has been great for us. And just in the short time I've been on the commission, Joe, you've been one of the best professionals that I've seen walk down the halls, and it's been great to work with you at all times, even tempered, dignified, informed, you know, memory like an elephant. It's been great, and I know that you've spread the good word as our ambassador through many countries who wish to have you back and like to have a partner to visit with, not only at the meetings but in the evenings and your travel, because you're a great raconteur and have a lot of fun with the people that are there. And I always ask, the first thing I got asked when I went down to my first visit, I had someone who was going to be my interpreter, and she said, where's Joe? I said, you're stuck with somebody else this time.
So thank you.
Thanks for everything.
Is there any further discussion on the motion? Perhaps we could finish that to approve the audit recommendation. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 6-0. And before we move on to the final, the next item on our agenda, I didn't want to cut off any. I think our colleagues have said it, but obviously I think the whole commission shares in thanking you for your service to the long service to the agency. I had thought that you might be joining us around for our next open meeting, but that's not the case. We obviously want to take this time to thank you very much for your service.
Thank you very much.
The next item on the agenda is the proposed meeting dates for the remainder of the calendar year that I proposed to the commission after much consultation. So I hope they remain acceptable to everyone. And if so, I would ask someone to make a motion. Commissioner Walther.
I'll make the motion. I just want to let you know I may miss August 4th, but I make a motion to approve. I'm going to try and make it, so I'm just giving you short notice.
Okay.
It's iffy one way or the other.
Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries 6-0. Mr. Palmer, are there any management or administrative matters for the commission?
Madam Chair, there are none.
Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.